Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. F up the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP, stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles, but we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro. Show, they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz, Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP, stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, Free the Black Panthers, FCBP, stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin sale pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black women and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die. NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Hi, Steve Kirsch. I'm Executive Director of the Vaccine Safety Research Foundation. And I have with me Ryan Cole. He's a pathologist who's been looking into all of these weird things with these mysterious blood clots and COVID deaths. And Ryan has had a lot of experience in this area. And I got a note recently from a a technician. He's a technician for a medical examiner. So, you know, when you die, it goes to the medical examiner sometimes. Sometimes it doesn't. But if it goes to the medical examiner, then the technician's actually the ones that do the work. And this technician was saying that he was finding these strange blood clots, which are not really blood clots. They're clots. And they're huge. And they're big. And they, you know, you can't live with these things in your body. And yet they're finding these weird, well, we'll call them telltale clots. And we're only finding these in people. It only started after the vaccines rolled out, right? These clots, never seen them before.
Correct.
Okay. So anyway, this technician was saying that he tried to get the pathologist to take a look at these clots, and they said, we are not going there, we're not touching it, we're not interested, and they don't want to see it. So this stuff is there in the bodies, but people are deliberately looking the other way. Now, have you seen that? Do you know of this as well from your personal experience, or is this new, what I just told you?
No, I have received similar reports from individuals that are seeing these things. I've received reports from nurses in hospitals that try to bring to the attention of the treating physicians that in vivo, before these patients do pass, that these patients have clots in proximity to their recent shot, et cetera. And medical examiners, same thing. I've received requests from all around the world, and I've got a couple I'm still working on because I want to dot every I, cross every T, make sure we can prove the deposition of certain things in the absence of others. It's kind of mind-boggling, to be quite honest. The pathologist, we're the reporter at the scene of a crash. We're the quality control of medicine. We don't cause a crash. We don't prevent a crash. We report what's there or what's not. It's straightforward science. And medicine has advanced over the centuries because of examining postmortem the bodies and learning the processes that lead to disease. So to ignore what's there is really anti-science. And I understand that they're afraid they may lose funding or they're going to get attacked. You know, I've been attacked constantly in the media, as have you. But it's our duty to humanity to do the science, whether you...
You know, I was talking with a nurse who was fired today, and she said that she's working with the family member of someone who died, and she said that they refused on the death certificate to... They have a Veris report. I mean, this person clearly died from the vaccine. They have a Veris report reporting the proximity of the vaccine to the death and you know, essentially implying the association. But on the death report, there was no mention of the vaccine at all, even after it was requested that it be added, that there's a possibility the person could have died from the vaccine. And also in the medical records, they did not include that this person had been vaccinated, even though, again, it was specifically requested that the medical records be corrected to be accurate. Now, if these people are deliberately falsifying information or withholding information, is that a violation of the law, or is that simply unethical?
Both. I think, well, it's medical malfeasance and it's negligence. It's medical negligence.
Could they go to, is it criminal? Could they go to jail?
I don't know the law to that degree, but... You know, the unfounded attacks that I've received from different medical boards that are, you know, second and third party political and have nothing to do with patient care, these omissions that you speak of are direct violations of medical codes in multiple states. Each state has different rules under state laws, but to me it sure seems unethical at the very least, but I think it rises to a level of negligence because they are not looking for...
Oh, it's more than negligence.
Yeah.
It's not just negligent because these people are notified that this is omitted and then they refuse to put it on.
Well, then that's...
So that's malice.
It's falsification of records. Absolutely.
That's malice.
Yeah, it is.
That's malicious.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about that. So have you... ever heard of a medical board going after a medical examiner or a pathologist or a doctor who omits this information and falsifies records, makes the vaccine look like it's not causing a problem? Have you ever heard of any medical boards anywhere going after a physician who is making the vaccine look better?
I haven't. You know,
okay. That doesn't mean it didn't happen.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I'm so busy with just, you know, keeping up with the pandemic and,
But I'll tell you what, Ryan, I am sure that my phone will be, my ears will be burning.
I'm sure they will.
If there is ever any pursuit by the medical boards of people who are doing malpractice that makes the vaccine look better. So if you do something that makes the vaccine look better, basically they are not going to go after you. I mean, it is, that's so unethical.
I have an interesting case from another country, and the father reached out. His son died after his second shot, and like days after, and he had an autopsy. The coroner said, well, gosh, we couldn't find anything. And so the father reached out, and I said, well, did you do this, 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 and this, which they didn't. And the father said, okay, I want the tissue sent to Dr. Cole. And then the coroner said, well, is he a medical examiner or a coroner? Well, that's part of pathology training. All of us do broad pathology training as part of our training. I've cut the tissue from my local coroner's office and do quality control on all the tissues times years, many years. And so every tissue that goes back to our local coroner's office goes through me. And he said, well, if he's not, board certified forensic pathologist, then we're not going to send him the tissues. And I said, well, I've only seen 500,000 tissue slides in my lifetime. It's not like...
Well, only 500,000.
Only 500,000. So,
you're a newbie.
Yeah, newbie, yeah. So not a spring chicken. So the absurdity of the coroner trying to block the ability of someone who wants to get an answer for that father as to why his son passed is being blocked. And
that's illegal, isn't it? Right?
If it's a different country, I'd have to look at their laws, but it's shameful.
In the U.S., that would be illegal.
Again, I'm not an attorney, but I mean, things like that are absurd, that people are trying to block grieved parents from knowing why their child passed. And there are ways to show through the microscope, through protein studies, through stains, through presence of virus or presence of a spike protein only from the vaccine, that we can show in and the paper from the American Heart Association last week showing that spike doesn't need an ACE2 receptor. It modulates the toll-like receptor number 4, causes myocytes to balloon. That paper alone should stop shots worldwide. We know giving a shot that has the potential to cause heart damage, it's known. And other countries have been wise, like Denmark, that finally said, hey, no more shots for anyone under 18. And then I saw a paper the other day that they're likely recommending for no one under 50. So to not look, you've heard me say many times, you cannot find that for which you do not look. And it's this intentional desire on the parts of all these individuals not to look. They don't want to prove what they think is probably there because they don't want to be held accountable for it. And, I mean, in the name of science, with the amount of damage that these shots have caused worldwide, it's heartbreaking to see that people are being denied the knowledge and opportunity to close the book on their loved one's passing and their loved one's harm. I don't know what's happened in the mind, the heart, the soul of medicine that people can be this hypnotized into a groupthink that says we're not going to look because we don't want to know. I don't get it. It's not why many of us went into medicine. We went into it for the patient, for science, and for truth. And if the truth is inconvenient, that doesn't matter. The truth is the truth, and you need to find it.
Yeah, well, we seem – so first of all, I want to ask you, are you a board-certified pathologist?
Board-certified anatomic clinical pathologist.
So there was no reason that you shouldn't have gotten the samples. Did you get the samples?
No, they won't send them.
Even though they said, is he a board-certified pathologist? The answer was yes, and they still wouldn't send the samples.
Correct. They said, well, you don't have a subspecialty board in forensics. Well, I've done more forensics than most average pathologists. I've done rotations at medical examiner's offices back in my early training. Most pathologists have to do, back when I was training, at least 200 autopsies for part of your board certification. I did 550. I trained at the Mayo Clinic, the busiest.
Did you actually talk to this guy?
It's been email communications with the assistant of the coroner, and then I've had a lot of communication with the father and another advocate that's trying to help the family.
Okay, so the bottom line is this. If you're he required you to be a board-certified pathologist in order to look at tissue samples that belongs to essentially the family, that the family should be able to control. Was this in the United States or this was outside the United States?
Outside the United States, but
okay.
Let's just say a neighboring country.
Okay, a neighboring country. Maybe it's Canada.
Maybe so.
Okay. And so first it was, well, I could only send it to him if he's a board-certified pathologist. So then when you are a board-certified pathologist, then the bar goes up. It's almost like, okay, and then if you had that particular subspecialty of forensics, then the bar would go up again. And then it would go up again and again until the bar was so high that you couldn't leap over it.
Correct. Yeah, it's a game.
Oh, he would have to be practicing for at least 20 years before I could send him, or he should have had been, you know, seeing at least a million samples. I mean,
and I guarantee you, in North America, there's probably 10 people that have seen as many biopsies as I've seen. And so, I mean, it's a circus of the absurd at this point. Because, okay, trained at the Mayo Clinic, busiest pathology program in the world, most complex cases in the world. Okay, check. Board-certified anatomical and clinical pathologist. Been in practice for 20 years independently, 26 years if you count my training. Vastly experienced. I know how we can prove or disprove that the shot did or didn't cause the demise of this young man.
Okay, and we're going to get into that. That's the meat of this segment, and I want to dive right into that, right? Because how many medical examiners today are doing the proper test to assess whether someone died from the vaccine?
About 7 in Germany.
Okay. How many in the United States?
None that I know of. There's one. Dr. Gill had a paper in the Archives of Pathology in which he looked at a 17 and 18-year-old, both two young men that died after their shots. He showed the catecholamine effect in the cardiac tissue and the myocarditis. But even in that paper, they didn't do a spike immunostain like they did in Dr. Burkhardt's studies out of Germany. So the ability to stain the tissues, so the spike protein is a specific protein. In the laboratory, we do what are called immunohistochemical stains, and these are very targeted. They will bind, and then they will glow if the spike protein is present in the tissues. And we can say, look at this. And Dr. Burkhardt showed this in his presentation with the other pathologists there in Germany. Spike is deposited here in the vessels, here in the heart, here in these organs, here in these tissues, here in neurologic tissue, etc. So it's commercially available now. It's expensive, but it can be done. And you can do it on fixed tissue that has been formalin fixed, but you can also, there are also immunofluorescence, glowing stains, where you can do it on fresh tissue as well. And now you can also tease out, because there's a broad array of these antibodies against these different proteins that we can use. So you can also say, well, gosh, if the nucleocapsid is present in that tissue, in addition to the spike, it was from a natural infection. I'm not saying all these things are only being caused by the shot. You know, we've known in 2020 there are a lot of pathologies that happened with the early variants and infections. But the vaccines, the shots, make the gene-based shots make more spike protein than the natural infection does, and we know that from multiple studies, including the ones out of Stanford that were published in the journal Cell by Dr. Roltgen. So, and she's a pathologist. So we know the mechanism whereby the spike binds and deposits in so many tissues in the body, and we can identify it. And the lack of desire of pathologists nationally and worldwide to look when the techniques are absolutely available is mind-boggling, because this is our job. In order to guide clinicians into better science long-term, it's a duty to humanity that we should be doing.
Yeah. You know, I just put on my screen there an excerpt from this Thailand paper. I don't know if you're familiar with it. They looked at cardiovascular issues. The Thailand paper found that there were significant cardiovascular differences in 29% of the young people that were injected with two shots of the vaccine.
Indeed,
and
yeah.
I think this was a Pfizer vaccine. Have you seen that?
I think I've seen that paper. I read so many papers
And 18% had, or was it 18 or 19% had abnormal EKGs.
Yeah, I did see that recently, yes.
Yeah, and I had it, so I just had it on my screen. Hopefully that worked out. How can you give someone a vaccine where 30% of the people, of the kids who receive it, now have cardiovascular issues? 30%. This is a Thailand study. This was a very well done study. And what's interesting is that if you look for this stuff, it's amazing what you can find. But it's amazing how many people just, you know, kind of, they look the other way or they have blindfolds on when they look at the data. And so this is why when we look at the data, we see some studies that report a lot of stuff and some studies that say, oh, it's just a minor effect. It's rare, as the CDC would say. It's not rare at all. I mean,
no.
That Thailand study is devastating. And the Burkhardt paper, that one's found in 93% of these cases where they got the tissue samples and they analyzed the tissue samples, and the coroner had ruled that none of these was a vaccine death. And in 93% of those cases, they found that these people were most likely, because you can never say no, you can always never say for sure, but they were most likely killed by the vaccine in 93%, and it wasn't even identified by the medical examiner. So you've looked at that Burkhardt study. Was that well done, and these guys know what they're doing?
Yeah, very comprehensive, and these are very experienced pathologists who are in the twilight of their careers. They have seen a lot of tissue, a lot of autopsies. They're very expert, and it's this... I was in Ireland this weekend, and Ivor Cummins, who I really like as an engineer and a data hound, you know, he and I were having a discussion. It's a three-legged stool. Number one, do you have the association? Number two, do you have the mechanism? And number three, now with those, can you do the scientific experiment to prove it? And we have all three, but people don't want to put that third leg on the stool and do the scientific experiment to prove it.
Yeah, they sure don't. Okay, so let's talk about the process. That if you were a medical, and you talked about this earlier in terms of the stains and so forth, but if you were, and then I want to talk about the composition of those mysterious clots that we're pulling out of people that are not blood, because Mike Adams analyzed it, and he found that these big blood clots, what people thought were blood clots, there was no blood in the blood clots. So... let's talk about that next. But the first thing is, you're a pathologist or you're a medical examiner. You get this body in. You typically don't even know whether the person's been vaccinated or when they're vaccinated, right?
No. Sometimes you'll get the hospital chart and sometimes you won't. You will have the circumstances in which the patient passed generally. And so good science is going in unbiased. And so you say, okay, here's what's in front of me. Now I'm going to systematically go through each organ grossly, and then at autopsy, technically, and usually have an autopsy assistant present. Now you examine the heart, you're going to examine the lungs, you're going to look for clots within the lungs, you're going to look for clots in the heart, and there's kind of this red gelatinous type clot that's very common post-mortem, but it's loose and jelly-like. It's not firm and rubbery. So you go through each organ system, and then you take generally a dime or a quarter-sized piece of every organ in the body, and if there's an unusual finding or a lesion, you're going to take tissues from that. You put those in fixative, and then we, in the laboratory, run them through our tissue processor to permanentize the tissue, embed them in wax, cut slides, and then once you have those cut slides, you examine, is there inflammation in this organ, inflammation in that organ? Are there tumor cells? Is there a different pattern? Are these cells degraded? And then you can say, okay, something's unusual here. Now those stains that I talked about a minute ago, now we're going to say, okay, let's see what's caused this change in pattern in this organ. And then your microscopic report combined with, hopefully, those who care to know doing those additional stains and studies, now you can conclusively bring the entire pathology autopsy report together with more conclusive findings saying that you've looked for everything, ruled out certain things, and or ruled in certain things. It's a very systematic algorithmic process. And and from Dr. Burkhart's group, he's laid forth, okay, if there's even a suspicion of a death post shot, here's the protocol, here's the forensic protocol and the algorithm in which to do it. And going back,
so he laid that out on paper that anyone can read?
Yeah, he has an entire protocol for pathologists to go through, and or family members, in which the pathologist is saying, oh gosh, we're not going to look at that. And kind of to the point earlier, pathologists who aren't board certified forensic pathologists in hospital systems and rural towns do autopsies all the time. It's part of our training. It's part of our expertise. So any pathologist can do an autopsy. And when they do that autopsy, they can do these tissue examinations and do the stains to find the presence or absence of spike protein and or other.
Would it be the pathologist that does the stains or the
physician does the stains, and we have special machines that do the, you know, the warming and the cooling and the denaturing so antibodies will bind and whatnot. So that's a technical, the histotechnical.
Right, but are these specialized stains in looking for spike protein and other, you know, signs of vaccine?
Yeah. So spike protein.
Okay, so they have to get the protocol, and presumably can send me a link to that so I can link it to the video of the protocol? Because that's the most important thing, is to make sure that people understand, here's, if the person's been vaccinated or you suspect because you see the blood clots, you should be doing this procedure.
Well,
so,
even if you don't see the blood clots, to look for the inflammation and or deposition of the spike in the cardiac tissues, because not everybody forms those clots, but some people do have extreme inflammation in certain organs because of the inflammatory nature of the spike causing infiltrates of inflammation into different organ systems.
And how would you know it's the can you tell it's the spike by looking at it, or do you have to do that off of the specialized stains?
With those specialized stains, because you can't see it just on standardized pathology slide stains.
Which is why nobody thinks that people were killed by the vaccine.
Correct.
Right?
They're not, again, it goes back to you cannot find that for which you do not look. So if you're not
going
to do those stains.
Yeah, but the more important. More importantly, those tools that they have for standard autopsies will not find, are guaranteed not to find any kind of vaccine association.
Correct. So you.
So which is why, which so this makes no sense, because the FDA, or sorry, the CDC, when they look at these autopsy reports, would be saying, well, we can't know whether this person died from the vaccine because, look, the they didn't do the proper stains.
Correct. They're not using the tools available.
So the CDC should be as mad as hell. They should be telling all these medical examiners, every single one of them, they should be demanding that these medical examiners do this so that we can assess the safety of these vaccines, because they're like having blinders on. It's like if your vaccine injured, they give you an MRI, right? You know, you're neurologically injured. They give you an MRI. All those injuries do not show up on an MRI, right? They're too small.
The cardiac injury will show on an MRI if you do contrast. However, there's a shortage of contrast because most of it's made in China. So a lot of these individuals with cardiac symptoms, especially these young patients, aren't getting a contrast MRI. That is the gold standard for myocarditis. And even clinically, unfortunately, it's not being done at the rate or the level. You know, those EKG changes in that Thailand study, sure, that's important, but the gold standard is to do an MRI with contrast.
Right. But for neurological changes,
see them on a scan.
You're not going to see them.
No, because it's at a microscopic level. And to your point, so number one, sure, the clots could be there, the microclots in the brain. However, there are other mechanisms in terms of damage. So lipid nanoparticles were originally designed to carry chemotherapy across the blood-brain barrier into the brain. We know the shots a lipid nanoparticle plus a gene sequence, that lipid nanoparticle diffuses and can land anywhere in the body. We know from the governmental data out of Israel, as much as we like to talk about cardiac issues, the governmental data out of Israel showed the most common side effect from the shots was neurologic. So that lipid nanoparticle can go through the vessels in the brain, take the sequence into the cells of the brain. There were good studies by Dr. Abramovich using something called Raman imaging, where they did in vitro, they were looking at all the different cell lines from the brain, and they showed that that spike protein gets into the mitochondria inside the cell. Now, the mitochondria is the powerhouse of your cell. It makes the energy of your cell. Well, that spike protein blocks production in the mitochondria of the electron transport chain. So the end product is ATP. This is what's energizing your cells all day long. The spike is damaging the mitochondria. So when you hear brain fog and fatigue, we know that the spike, and there was another study too that showed that there was cardiac mitochondrial damage. If you don't have the energy for the cells, you can't produce proper membranes, you can't produce proper proteins, you can't produce proper energy. So that's another mechanism. Dr. Abramovich's study, Dr. Clough out of Poland, there are studies that confirm that the spike causes these harms. Now, to your question, on neurologic tissue as well, we can do those simple stains pathologically to see in those tissues, is there spike deposited? And I'll be, you know, fair and say, okay, if it's a COVID death, is there nucleocapsid, which means the spike and the nucleocapsid indicates that the whole virus is there. If only the spike is there, then it's a stronger indicator that it's only from the shot and the body making this toxic protein.
Okay, so the brain fog. Is the brain fog caused by the damage to the mitochondria, or is it caused by something else?
Well, I conjecture three things. So number one, definitely the mitochondrial damage. Number two, we know that the lipid nanoparticle in and of itself is inflammatory. And the lipid nanoparticle without the genetic sequence in it is inflammatory. And there are great papers confirming that. We've known this for a long time. So inflammation in the brain, this is why fluvoxamine works, because fluvoxamine is a sigma-1 agonist which blocks IRE1, inositol-requiring enzyme number 1, which leads to cytokine production. So fluvoxamine will decrease inflammation in neural tissues and in the body. So inflammation 1, microclotting number 2, because if you don't get adequate perfusion of tissues, obviously cells aren't going to function normally. And then number 3, mitochondrial damage. So we have plausible mechanisms and proven mechanisms in the literature for all of these things to be happening. And we know the shots are a dose-dependent toxicity. The more one gets, you know, I tell people, look, I'm not here to judge. Some people chose to doing what they thought was right at the time. But if you got one, don't get two. If you got two, don't get three. If you got three, don't get four. We have Burks saying, well, gosh, we knew the vaccines wouldn't prevent infection publicly. And meanwhile, we have Walensky saying, well, make sure you get two boosters. But we know that the more spike your body makes, the more damage the cells are going to experience from having chronic spike production and the presence of a sequence that doesn't break down in the body very easily. This mRNA has a pseudouridine instead of uridine. The body, you and I are making proteins right now, little messages from our cells saying make this, make that, make this, and that mRNA breaks down for whatever protein our cell is making in minutes to hours. With this synthetic sequence, gene-based shot, with that pseudouridine, this sequence is persisting, and again, Dr. Roltgen's study out of Stanford, it's persisting in the body for at least 60 days in some patients.
And some thinks it's a year or more.
It may be, because they stopped their study at 60 days so they could go to publication.
Right.
And like Burkhardt's study, 120 plus days, and one of those patients, spike was deposited in the vessel walls. The Journal of Immunology study that showed spike in exosomes. And then, you know, from severe infections, some patients are still making spike. Dr. Bruce Patterson's studies confirmed circulating spike in monocytes. So this spike, you know, whether from a bad natural infection versus from the shots, and again, we know the shots.
So this is a long COVID. essentially.
So long COVID can be spike-based and or long COVID can be reactivation of latent viruses, especially Epstein-Barr virus. So a lot of patients that are experiencing fatigue, number one, it may be mitochondrial, but number two, Epstein-Barr virus is really a bear to deal with. I personally have dealt with it physically since a surgery I had 3.5 years ago that reactivated Epstein-Barr virus in my body. 95% of adults have had Epstein-Barr, and so it sits quiet in your body. Your immune system keeps it in check until there's an insult that reawakens it. So that's another one in a lot of these patients where they're experiencing severe lethargy and fatigue that one needs to look for. Very, very, very simple blood test that, you know, draw a tube of blood and look for the presence of, you know, a panel of 4 Epstein-Barr virus antibodies and see how activated the nuclear and the early capsid are. And then you can say, okay, here's one very provable reason that this injured patient is fatigued. But going to those other things, you know, if a patient has a biopsy, then we can look for, is there chronic spike present in tissues, and or through Dr. Patterson's study, they can prove, is there spike still circulating and causing inflammation and damage in these long-haul patients as well.
So I meant to ask you earlier, when a medical examiner takes these samples and puts them on slides and stains them, that lasts forever, right? I mean,
Yeah, when I was at Mayo, I had a colleague that was doing a study on the 1918 flu. We had Mayo keeps tissue forever, and that's the beauty of it. Once it's fixed, once that tissue's fixed and you keep it in a temperature-stable environment, which we do with all our tissues, then you can go back and study it from 100 years ago. That's the interesting thing, and that's the reason I save a lot of tissues, because a patient may have a rare tumor, and there may not be certain treatments, but if a new treatment comes along and you can go back from the end and the patient's still alive, look at their tissue from a year or two ago, now you can do new stains and new cell cycle pathways and say, gosh, they're expressing this protein. Now they're a candidate for this new treatment.
Okay, you said something. I'm going to stop you there because you said something really important, which is you can do new stains. So you're saying that if you died a year ago, we can do the proper stains on you.
Any and every
determine whether you have died from the vaccine.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, this is news. I didn't know this. I bet most people didn't know this. That's extraordinary.
And it's critically important. So if that question remains in a family's mind and an autopsy was performed and that medical examiner, and earlier on, these stains weren't available. But if they did do them, the family can say, hey, look, I still suspect based on proximity and based on symptomatology that my loved one passed from this. I would like you to go back and look at those tissues, and I want you to stain them and tell me present or not present. And if they choose not to, the family, to your point earlier, should be able to say, okay, I want them to go to an expert, a laboratory that will do them and prove presence or absence.
So Ryan, the CDC basically says, hey, we couldn't find an association. And of course, nobody's staining them for the association. So shouldn't the CDC go back to all these people where they have the autopsy reports and go back to the family and say, hey, these people might have died from the vaccine. We're the CDC. We want to make sure it's safe and effective, especially safe. Why do you think the CDC isn't going back to any of those medical examiners or anybody who sent in the autopsy report? And they have plenty of autopsy reports. It was documented in that paper Rosenblum and Gee, it was published in The Lancet, and they talked about the number of autopsy reports that they have. Why wouldn't the CDC go back to all of those people and say, hey, please stain it for this, 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 and this, because we want to find out whether this person died from the vaccine?
Well, you and I know that why question is hard to answer, but these are regulatory captured agencies by the pharmaceutical industries.
They don't want to know.
And you know, in the President's Day article in the New York Times, the CDC admitted it was withholding the majority of the COVID data from the United States citizens. We also know that the CDC, through FOIA requests, that they were not monitoring the injury systems. They weren't looking at theirs. They weren't looking at their additional better systems. They weren't looking.
Yeah, so they weren't looking at the best system. It's actually called the best system. They say that the best system that they have for monitoring this is called, ironically, the best system. But we have never seen any data at all from the best system, and they have concealed the Medicare all-cause mortality data as well. They will not show us any of the Medicare data at all. That is behind closed doors. I had to have a whistleblower get that, and, man, the Medicare data shows all-cause mortality is at an all-time high. What do you know?
You bet. And this is what's fascinating. To have all these answers, in medicine, everything is coded. And you can search by code for this condition, that condition, that condition, that condition. It's all available. And it's in that HHS CMS system. And one could just simply go in and say, I am going to query this code, simple study to do, and to withhold that. You know, it's patient protected. The code is a standalone independent variable. You don't have to go into, you know, the patient information, nothing of that sort, but you can simply track the codes and you can track the upticks and the downticks, and you know what's present or absent. So we as American citizen taxpayers, we fund those agencies. That's data that's important to the general public health. To withhold that doesn't make any sense.
So even if the agencies themselves are captured, there is nothing that keeps a member of Congress or someone in the White House like Ashish Jha or the President of the United States from telling the CDC, hey, any of those autopsy reports, I want to have the stains done. Because even though you, Mr. Captured Agency, don't want to see it, I want to see it. So that means that Biden is in on it, because he's not asking for that data, and Jha isn't asking for that data. Nobody in the White House is asking for the data, and nobody in Congress is asking for the data so that we can see an association. Nobody wants to know.
Well, I'll give Ron Johnson credit for querying. Yeah. You know, he sent multiple oversight letters. And
they just get ignored.
They do. All of them have been ignored. And so I think when the House flips this fall and then there are investigative committees, I think a lot of these agencies are going to have a lot of questions to answer. Because this isn't about, you know, the sad aspect of this is it's so money-driven and it's so narrative-driven. A virus isn't political. And to see harm and damage to humanity and to the youth and to people who have lost their jobs, et cetera, and to have the CDC change all the guidelines yesterday as though they wave their magic wand and say, okay, you don't have to do all these things anymore, which is going to support a lot of people's lawsuits, don't get me wrong. But they're just trying to normalize everything they've done. These are not the droids you're looking for. Don't look at this. Just keep, you know, good, you know, move on. No, don't move on. These are things that the American people that aggrieved and harmed individuals deserve to know. It's basic science, and science always advances, but science won't advance if you won't do the things that are available and use the tools in the toolbox. Then you go backwards. We have motorized vehicles that get us from A to B very quickly, and they're saying, well, just the horse and buggy, that's all we want you using is horse and buggy. Don't use that car even though it's available. It doesn't make sense.
Okay. So let's talk. I'm going to switch gears for a second here. I want to talk about how what you can do if you're vaccine injured, right? If you're injured, how do you recover from it? Is the FLCCC protocol, or is there something else that you know about to treat that? Why don't you address that real quick, and then I want to get into how much Tony Fauci is making for each shot, and whether the virus was created in a lab, and we'll talk about Professor Sachs. So
there are multiple pathways to injury and or long-haul disease. So in a laboratory, if it's microclotting, there's a test called a D-dimer that says, are you breaking down clots? And if we detect an elevation of that D-dimer, number one, we know, okay, you have clot formation. So then you can go to the FLCCC's protocol. Are you on anticoagulants, blood thinners? Are there things that the individual is taking? So clotting is one. Chronic inflammatory processes, like we said, so tuning down inflammation with fluvoxamine, steroids, et cetera. And these are just basic blood tests. Most doctors know what they can order to look for different markers. And another interesting one is mast cell activation syndrome. So some patients become very hyper-inflammatory allergic. And I've seen both post-COVID as well as post-shot patients developing allergies that they never had. I have one patient, healthy athlete, national champion level, who now has 30-plus allergies. And so that's another pathway. So these different protocols, so there you have to obviously eliminate your new allergens and look at that pathway. And then as I was mentioning earlier, because of the downregulation of pattern receptors in the body, latent viruses in the body are allowed to wake up. We suppress the innate immune system with these shots. And that was a great paper out of the Netherlands by Dr. Fossa et al., showing the suppression of the innate immune system, which allows other viruses to wake up. So that's another panel of tests one needs to look at in terms of causing symptomatology in patients. So each of these pathways, you know, mitochondrial damage, there's some very complex tests where you can measure mitochondrial activity that are generally done by mass spec and at reference labs. So that can be assessed as well. So there are multiple mechanisms of potential injury. And then there are multiple mechanisms of potential treatment that may overlap. So the
FLCCC protocol, for example, is a subset of what you just talked about.
Correct. And I know Dr. Corey very well, and he and I have talked quite a bit on certain things. And I love what they're doing, and fantastic. And I think there are a couple other things that need to be added to that protocol, especially the microbial reactivation panels. I think that's one that sometimes gets overlooked in many of these different recommended panels and detoxes, et cetera, like World Council for Health has some. Dr. Blett and Dr. McCullough, Tree for Health Foundation, have some. FLCCC has some. There are many groups trying to help individuals reverse what's happening, which is fantastic. But I think there's overlap in some, and I think again, the science is continually evolving, and we'll continue to find additional mechanisms of injury and harm. And once we know that, now new therapies or supplementations or life changes become available to try to counter some of those.
So where would I find the most definitive guide, the most comprehensive guide to, you know, your guide to vaccine injury? Who has that? Who wrote that?
I like the FLCCC's.
But you say it needs to be expanded, so there isn't an expanded version.
And I'm not criticizing, because everybody has their areas of expertise, and they're my friends and colleagues. So I mean, if I spent a week, if I could get away from the scope for a week and not travel for a week, I'd sit down and I did a recent presentation where I tried to be pretty comprehensive on the panels, and I can send you that.
Yeah, you know, hey, if you just publish Dr. Cole's addendum to the FLCCC protocol, I think that'd be a hot little item.
Yeah,
that would benefit millions of people, Ryan.
Well, I challenge taken. I will slow down enough to do that. Because there are things that can be done, and I love certain out-of-the-box things that can be done, like mitochondrial reactivation with near-infrared light therapy, or helping that electron transport chain in damaged individuals with methylene blue.
These things that you've talked about, you know, I can tell you, I had a friend who saw one of the experts at Stanford on he basically 99% is treating vaccine injured. Mm-hmm. And you know what he says? We don't know what causes it. We don't know how to treat it, but I'll try this. And if you get better, that is a state of the art, my friend. That is a state of the art. We have no clue what's causing this. We have no clue as to what to do to treat it. But some people do get better after 9 months. But, you know, it probably wasn't because of anything that I did, because I don't know what I'm doing. This is the top Stanford. This is the top doctor at Stanford. It's the one that everybody who's vaccine injured goes to see.
You cannot find that for which you do not look. If you're not doing a comprehensive workup of the multiple pathways of injury, you're not going to find it, you're not going to treat it, and you're not going to resolve it. Now, there are multiple therapies that have helped a lot of patients, and I do like a lot of what Dr. Corey is doing because I think it's very helpful. And then there are other things I think these, quote, experts from these universities need to be looking at. I mean, that's what I like about Dr. Merrick and Dr. Corey is they're looking outside of the box. And these universities, again, their funding is dependent on the federal government. So if they say that the cause was a shot, they're going to lose funding for speaking truth. And that's the frustration is as much as I'm trying to do what I can do on small studies and in small cohorts, they have the ability and the funding to do it on large scale and help a lot of people. And so, again, I would encourage my colleagues to be brave, to be bold and say, look, we're not beholden to the government. We're beholden to the patient. That's the oath we took. We know the tools are available. Let's start using the tools.
All right. I'm going to switch gears here. Do you know how much Tony Fauci makes every time there's a Moderna shot that's given to someone?
I know a lot goes back to the NIH because the NIH co-holds the patent on the spike and the sequence. And
right.
So,
and do you know how much is distributed to Tony Fauci?
I do not. I just know a lot of money goes back his direction.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because nobody knows how much money Tony Fauci makes per shot. And when Tony is asked about it, he just deflects, saying, oh, it's public information. It's not public information, and you can't even get it on a Freedom of Information Act request because it's redacted. Isn't that a conflict of interest when you have the guy, the number one pusher of the vaccine, is making money, and it is not disclosed how much money he makes every time someone gets shot with Moderna? And by the way, how many people know that the name of the Moderna vaccine, it's not the Moderna vaccine, it's the Moderna NIAID vaccine. And in other words, we have the fox guarding the hen house, that the that NIH is basically pushing a drug that they have their name on and then they get compensated on, and they compensate the individuals. I mean, that's pretty corrupt unless you disclose to the American people, hey, I'm only getting a dollar a shot, right? So when there are 200 million shots, I'm only making $100 million. I have no, you know, conflict of interest at all when I recommend people take this shot. I mean, he should be I am so upset. He should be telling people exactly how much he makes from Moderna and how much the other people at NIAID make on these shots. Because to not do that, that's a conflict of interest, and none of these people in Congress are asking for that. Rand Paul asked for it, but he didn't get it.
No, he didn't, and it is an absolute conflict of interest. And again, for agencies to be mandating a shot in which the government has a financial interest, then should be illegal in my mind.
Okay. Now, the virus. Everything I have seen says this virus was created in a lab, and it's tied to U.S. labs. And Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who was head of the committee to investigate the source of the virus, his conclusion was, as far as we can tell, this thing was manufactured in a U.S. bio lab, and now the United States doesn't want to pursue it anymore to see exactly where and who. Is that how science works, that once you sort of get over the target, that they pull back and dismantle your committee and say we're not interested in the problem anymore to find out what's going on? And why didn't anybody in Congress ask for Tony Fauci's unredacted emails? You see, that's what I can't figure out. Because any Democratic committee chairman can send a letter to the NIH requesting Tony Fauci's unredacted emails and get it. The Republicans can't because they're not committee chairmen, but the Democrats can get the unredacted emails, and we would see exactly what happened when Tony found out it was released and how he worked with Christian Anderson to manipulate the science so that in the course of just like 2 or 3 days, it went from, Tony, we're sure this came out of a lab, to, oh, it's natural origin. They had no data, and they had 2 days to do that. How is that even possible?
Yeah, and these are all great questions. There are sequences in that spike protein that, like the furin cleavage site, that's not, you don't find that in nature.
Well, you do,
but in
not
this
the virus.
In this family of viruses, you don't.
Right.
So we
but you do find it in a 2015-2016 Moderna patent.
Yes, you do.
So you find it only in a Moderna patent on a vaccine for SARS-CoV-2, and you find it that was done years before the virus gets released. And also, you have Stéphane Bancel is the CEO of Moderna, but he had a business partner. His business partner was involved in the construction of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And coincidence, across the, I think it's the Yangtze River, just across, you just go right across the river. I mean, the Wuhan Institute of Virology is right on one side. You go right on the other side of that river, and that's where the wet market is, where the outbreak happened. I mean, that is an amazing set of coincidences, isn't it? That 19 nucleotide sequence from the early Moderna patent pops up and related to coronavirus, and then it pops up in the Wuhan, right next to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. What do you think the chances of that happening are?
Very small, infinitesimally small.
Nobody's talking about this stuff, Ryan.
And then that's the whole thing. Everybody blames it on China, but this was gain-of-function research occurring in Barrick's lab in North Carolina.
Yeah, that we funded.
Yeah, that we funded. And
Tony funded it.
Right. And then he has an interest on the board of Moderna, and he has an interest at the NIH, and the money's going back, et cetera. And again, basic sequencing tells you, okay, natural virus, unnatural, engineered. And other inserts within the viral spike sequence don't belong in the coronavirus family. So it's clearly biologically manipulated experimentally. And, you know, intentionally released accidentally, who knows? Nobody can prove that yet. Nobody's looking. Or maybe they are and not telling us. I don't know. But at the end of the day, it got released on humanity, is incredibly harmful. There are conflicts of interest galore. And then they're being swept under the rug. And to your point, we have the mechanisms whereby we could ask these individuals, subpoena information, request those emails, request all these communications. They work for us. We fund them. We, as a harmed nation and world, deserve the answers, because the answers are available if people are truthful and transparent. But they're not. And these agencies have not been truthful and transparent. The science can clearly, and the communications could clearly answer these questions.
And nobody wants to know the answers to these questions on the Democrat side, on the White House side. It's just amazing. They had a special commission. The president established a special commission to look into the origins of the coronavirus, and they came back saying, we can't figure it out, sir. Now, that commission never even asked for Tony's unredacted emails. And when the WHO went to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, they were not able to look at any genomic sequences that they were working on. Isn't that odd?
Yeah,
it's almost as if they were trying to hide something.
So much of the databases were deleted.
And yeah.
That's a pretty good tell, is what one would
it's
call
it. It's a pretty good tell. You know, you saw that Jon Stewart thing on the Colbert Show, right?
Oh, that was hilarious, yes.
Now, it doesn't really say on their business card the, you know, beta coronavirus research lab to infect. I'm like, that's
right.
Not true, right? He was making that up, right?
It was funny how he connected the dots, because it's so obvious to the most casual observer.
Yeah, but it doesn't have their on the business card. It didn't say the okay.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
I just wanted to make sure of that.
No, it doesn't have that, but I mean, the conclusions he drew were
it was done in a very entertaining way.
Yes,
I loved that episode. Okay, so let's get back. Has the CDC ever called you, Dr.
No.
Cole? Hey, I hear you're an expert. I hear you know about these strange blood clots that are appearing in vaccinated people. Now, you would think that you would be getting inundated with phone calls from the CDC, and you would think that Dr. Nath, who is the specialist who's been looking at vaccine injured for over a year, and he can't find an association. Now, you would think that Dr. Nath would be on the phone, that you and Dr. Nath would be best friends at the NIH. Have you ever talked to Dr. Nath?
No, and in just about every talk I give, I say, hey, look, you don't have to agree with what I'm finding or what I see or what I share from the literature and the data, but we should have a conversation if you disagree with me so that we can come to agreement. Bring better data than I have.
Sure.
And they never want to do that. And
no, they sure don't.
No, they and you've made those requests for having debate, to have an open forum. And in just about every talk I give, I do the same thing. I said, look, let's have open scientific dialogue. And instead they claim, no, we're the science, and we don't want dialogue.
Yeah, you can't.
Because they're hiding things from the American people.
Yeah,
and this is obviously a virus that harmed a subset of susceptible individuals. I've got tons of papers showing why. But also this shot has harmed countless individuals, the most dangerous medical product ever released on humanity. There's no reason it should exist in the marketplace anymore. But these individuals from these agencies have, I think there's just a financial interest and or a power and control interest or a fear that drives their behavior that keeps them from allowing the truth to come forth. And it's incomprehensible. I don't understand why all those things trump the human condition.
Yeah, you know, so Martha Sharon will not let me talk to anyone at the CDC. And when I call up the people at the CDC directly, they said, oh, you have to get permission from Martha. I have left numerous voicemails. I have left numerous emails for Martha Sharon. And I get nothing back. They basically shield all of these people from any accountability and any questions, because I would just love to get any of these people on a recorded video call for 15 minutes, and it'll be very clear who is telling the truth.
Absolutely.
And who is lying to people.
And they
don't want that to happen.
This is where, when hopefully things change, oversight will happen and there will be deep investigations, because the fraud and the crime behind all of this, I think, is going to be very provable, and I think the American people are going to understand what they experienced at the hands of agencies that weren't fulfilling their responsibilities to us as taxpaying citizens. And again, these are private entities that are technically contracted with the government. So the CDC is technically a private agency, a pseudo-governmental agency. So is the FDA, a pseudo-governmental agency. So it's very frustrating to look at how they're being protected by politics when humanity is being harmed by what they're not doing. The problem is what they're omitting. They're committing things, but they're omitting things as well. And I agree with you. If they want our trust, then they have to be truthful and transparent. Truth plus transparency equals trust. It's very simple. And if they want the American people's trust, that's all they need to do. Here's the truth. Here's transparency. And again, in real science, The answer is whatever the answer is. Whether it's convenient or inconvenient, the science is repeatability and provability. And if they don't want to allow us to see that, then they're hiding something. And I think they're hiding a lot of connections, and there's things I can't prove. My expertise is here at the microscope with the cells, with the proteins, with the genetics, with the patterns. But one can look synthetically as a human being and synthesize, gosh, there's a pattern that's broken in society and broken in our government. And those things do need to be fixed.
Yeah. You know, you are so calm. Listening to you, you are so calm about this. And I get so emotional about this because of all of the death and mm-hmm. the injuries that have been caused by this and the frustration that there's so little accountability. Like, you can't hold these people accountable. You have Carol Crawford at the CDC colluding with the social media companies to censor people who are trying to get the word out. And I'm like, you know, been banned twice. Like, I have two lifetime bans on Twitter. And I'm trying to get the truth out to people. And I'm the guy being censored. And, you know, Carol Crawford should be coming to my rescue. She should be telling Twitter, why did you ban this guy? He's telling the truth. But she doesn't want to talk to me.
The truth in this day and age is sadly a relative thing. And
yeah.
Dr. Malone and I, with Dr. Bowden and others, stood on the steps of the headquarters of Twitter in Dublin and did a little protest because we're trying to flip the bird. Hashtag flip the bird. But,
I like that.
Transparency. Again, they've become a propaganda arm of who knows what agency, so have all the major media companies, and we know the White House has colluded with Facebook and other social media platforms. And again, they're trying to hide things. They're trying to take away free speech. They're trying to take away the ability of the American people to know truth. And to your point, whatever under legal grounds we can do for accountability down the road, I think is absolutely going to be necessary.
Yeah. You know, I was on Fox News.
I saw that. Great segment, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. You know, it was kind of unplanned. I didn't know I was supposed to stick to the script. So I went off script thinking like, okay, you know, because I talked to the producer. He says, hey, he'll just ask you questions. There are no prepared questions. So I'm thinking like, okay, I can go off script. So I went off script, and boy, that guy was, Brian was really surprised I went off script. And he was saying, well, we can't verify that. But so I offered Fox the opportunity to verify everything that I said. I sent them a text back saying, hey, happy to provide all the data so you can verify every single thing I said. I didn't hear from them. It's not that we can't. It's that we aren't going to. But maybe he was actually being truthful, that we can't verify that. Because if we did verify it, we would find out you were telling the truth.
Right.
And if you're telling the truth, then all of that drug company advertising from Pfizer will go away. And so the reason that we can't verify it is because our business people won't allow us to verify it. So I got to give the guy credit. He was telling me the truth. They can't verify it.
Right.
They are not allowed to look at the data.
And that's where that era of investigative journalism has kind of gone by the wayside, because these entities have become too big and all these intertwining interests and financial interests, they don't want to bite the hand that feeds them. I get that. It's unfortunate. So many of us have lost so much because these large media individuals have the voice, and we try to get the truth out and we get suppressed. And so people are harmed. They're collusively harming citizens of the world by not doing their ethical duty to humanity. And that's my biggest concern. We can do the science if they'll allow us to. We can show what's happening if they'll allow us to. We're going to keep doing it no matter what, to the rate and degree that we can. But this should all be funded by these agencies. This should all be in the interest of humanity. It should be, we care about you, our citizens. We know we work for you. We are going to do the best by you to help you. And they're not. Instead, they're attacking us. They're smearing us, defaming us. They're hiding science. They're hiding communications. They're hiding financial interests. And it's harming. They, you know, they say, oh, well, you've got to do all this to protect grandma. Guess what? They're the ones harming grandma.
Right.
And now, harming the children. And harming everybody else.
Yeah. And I went on Fox, and I basically said that these people that, you know, and the CDC is responsible and the FDA is responsible, that we have killed hundreds of thousands of Americans, and we have injured millions of Americans.
And perhaps long-term shorten the lives of many, because we still don't know the long-term side effects
right.
in terms of all the mechanisms of harm that this synthetic sequence causes and the spike protein causes. So we still don't have that view, the long-term view.
So you would not disagree with anything I said?
No, not at all.
Okay. And so here's the stunning thing. The stunning thing is that I was inundated with texts and emails and messages and so forth. And they all said, you know, this is the first time we have ever heard this on Fox before.
On mainstream media altogether. And that's where, you know, kudos to you for getting that out there, because hopefully it'll wake some people up and they'll say, wait a minute, what was he saying? And of course, you know, you're going to get attacked by all the left-wing sources that have financial interest in this. Whatever the cabal is, who knows, who can prove what. But at the end of the day, you brought truth to the American people and hopefully woke up some minds that said, wait, is what he's saying true? And where do we find that information? And hopefully more people will start looking, because there are countless people, and you've written about this on your Substack in terms of the number of people that know somebody who's been injured or killed. And like Wayne Allyn Root's, you know, wedding party, and the number of individuals killed or harmed that had been in that cohort. So obviously those are anecdotal, but when you add up so much of it, that's how medicine, that's how science advances, is you make large observations or small observations that start adding up to large observations. And once you have enough observational data, you say, wait, you can't ignore the observations.
That's right. Yeah, you know, the people I talk to are trained in medical school to only look at randomized clinical trials as if that is the gold standard and those can't be gamed. So they only look at the randomized trials and they only listen to authority. And so they are like wired to those two things. So if you give them an anecdote, what they tell you is, oh, that's an anecdote. And the plural of anecdote is anecdotes. It's not data. And this is the mindset, and it is impossible to break that mindset. It is drilled into them, because that is not how science works. The way that science works is to look at all the observations, and you may have hundreds or thousands of observations, and then you say, I have this hypothesis, and you have this hypothesis. Looking at all of the observations, which hypothesis better explains what is observed? And so when you have something like Wayne Root's wedding, to me, that was like a beautiful case, because this is the kind of study that the CDC should be doing, but they haven't done it for any vaccine at all, because they know all the vaccines are dangerous. And so Wayne's study, just for people who don't know, he had a wedding. He invited 200 guests. It turned out afterwards that half the guests were vaccinated and the other half were not. So it was almost like a 50-50 perfect mix. And what he found was that of the 100 people who were vaccinated at his wedding, 26 people had severe injuries and 7 people died. And in fact, if you count the person who died right before his wedding, it's 8 people. In the other group, it was 0 and 0. Ryan, I ran the numbers. The p-value on that is like 10 to the minus 8.
Yeah.
Okay? Like, you don't need many anecdotes like that. When, you know, you could say, oh, well, that could be confounded or whatever. But I've got anecdotes up the wazoo.
Sure.
Like, just like that. And I went off on Gab, and I tried to get an anecdote on the other side of comparable value, and I found 0.
Yeah. No, nobody
and the p-value of that one is extraordinary. That
yeah.
you get – You get like 480 on one side and you get zero on the other. The p-value of that is like 10 to the minus 86 or something like that. I mean, I was floored. There is no doubt about it. These things are as dangerous as it gets, and nobody's paying attention.
Well, and you know, this is one thing I've been emphasizing lately, is if you take a lipid nanoparticle, and Moderna executives a couple of years ago said that we have no guarantee that lipid nanoparticles are safe in the human body. They said that. And Acuitas out of Canada that makes lipid nanoparticles, there's two of the agents in there where it says, look, these are for research purposes only, not for human consumption. So we have a dangerous lipid nanoparticle. You combine it with a synthetic sequence that doesn't stay in the arm, goes anywhere. So a lipid nanoparticle plus a synthetic genetic sequence as a supposed vaccine, it's really a gene therapy. Or it's not changing your genes. It's a gene being put into the body to make your body do something. These companies now think that they can do it for RSV and for flu and for TB and for HIV. They don't have 10 years of safety data on this platform. And maybe you've heard me in that one interview say, look, it's a nuclear bomb, because we can't control where the lipid goes. We can't control where that sequence goes. And they think they have carte blanche now going forward to use this technology to put it into anyone and everyone. And then those harms that you point out with incredible p-values, there's no contrapositive to it. They're not bringing any counter information or observational data or anecdotes. And now they want to do this with any shot going forward with no long-term safety. This is where, okay, sure, the COVID shots are expired. The Wuhan variant went extinct a long time ago. Now they're formulating their bivalent for this fall. The BA5 is going to be gone by this fall. So now they're going to give you two sequences for two extinct viruses. And it doesn't make any sense. And they're using a platform which we know is intrinsically harmful. And now they think they want to do it for any shot going forward with an intrinsically harmful platform.
Yeah. You know what's amazing to me is that, remember when the virus was first discovered in the U.S. and we got the genomic sequence, and then we gave the genomic sequence to Moderna and we gave it to Pfizer. And in two days, Moderna came back and said, we have a vaccine candidate. Now, how is it, Ryan, that for a novel virus that you've never seen before, it takes you 2 days to come up with a vaccine candidate, but when you have these variants, that you can't come up with any vaccine against the variants?
I've asked this very question because there was a press release or a comment, yes, we're working on an Omicron shot, it's going to be several months, blah, 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 and I asked that same question. Well, if they came up with it in just a few days on that very first variant, why in the name of science would that, I mean, that, again, speaking of something that's a tell, there's another tell.
Yeah, and we don't have an explanation for that. You know, and Stéphane Bancel was asked, hey, what about that 19 nucleotide sequence that was in your pants? How did it show up in the virus? And he said, we're looking at it. Our scientists are looking at it, and we'll get back to you. Well, wasn't that like a year ago?
Right.
They haven't gotten back to us.
I don't think they have.
And nobody is asking, hey, so how's it going? What did your scientists find? You know, because I would love to know what their, maybe I should go and do a press request so I can interview Stéphane Bancel to find out, you know, because I'm sure he'd want to end all of the COVID misinformation. So I'd like to ask him, like, hey, how's that going when you asked your scientists how that sequence just got into this this virus that came out of nature?
With your patent in it, yeah.
Hear how he's going to answer that question. Let's get to the clots.
Okay.
These are not blood clots, and these are like massive. These things like run like what, three or four, what's the longest you've seen, like 4 feet long?
In the ones I've received from around the country, the longest I've had is maybe, you know, 16 inches. I've seen the pictures of the long ones in the entire leg veins that are, you know, 2 feet, 3 feet long. I've seen
right.
them.
Okay. But the ones you actually have in hand are, oh, you have one.
Oh, yeah.
Lunch, perhaps.
Yeah, pull out the lunch file here. But, I mean, that's all coiled up here.
Yeah.
And yeah,
it's very rubbery.
Very rubbery, yeah, very proteinaceous. So, you know, Mike Adams says there's no blood in them. Well, no, there's blood trapped in between, but they're a thick protein. Now, I did some initial stains looking for a certain type of amyloid, and it didn't stain for that one type of amyloid. Now, Dr. Pretorius out of South Africa, she's looked at these, and she says they're amyloid-like. So there are several types of, and amyloid is basically different proteins congealed together, and then they fold in certain patterns. So do these still have some fibrin that you would see in normal clots in them? They do. Do they have, like, trapped blood cell elements, white and red cells, within that proteinaceous material? They do. But are they more clumped, rubbery protein than they are traditional clot? Yes. Yes, and so I've gone ahead. And so, you know, this is what I've done so far, and here's, well, I don't know, about 60 slides looking at these clots under the scope and doing certain stains on them and still trying to, okay, it has this, it doesn't have that. I've got a couple more proteins coming that we're going to stain them with. And so as one looks at them, and a couple of them, you know, are secondarily from, some of them do have, like, secondary bacteria deposited, so some of these patients were septic in addition. So there's a whole array of findings, and the mechanisms is really what we're, you know, working on. Dr. Pretorius showed that S1 portion of the spike, you can take all the platelets away. You know, you skin your knee, your platelets help seal that off, and the oozing stops. You can take the platelets away, and that S1 fragment still causes the proteins to clump. And there's certain receptors on cells called CD147. We have it on our lymphocytes, on our platelets, on our red cells, on our blood cell lining that S1 binds to and induces clotting processes as well. And it induces the proteins to clump. So we have the mechanism. Interestingly, ivermectin displaces the S1 fragment of the spike from that receptor and from that clotting mechanism. So there are
that horse drug that the FDA recommends you don't use.
Actually, highly intelligent doctors with when it has 21 mechanisms of action, and the government's using a one-trick pony that's allowing, you know, rebound cases with Paxlovid and other things.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, one of the
suffice it to say, you don't recommend Paxlovid, and you do recommend ivermectin. Would that be true?
Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting because things shift scientifically. So, like with Omicron, actually, hydroxychloroquine has been more effective early on with Omicron virus, and then but there are different mechanisms between hydroxy and iver, and because of that, you know, for certain things you use this, and others you use that. But for anti-clotting, ivermectin is great. But the best, guess what? The best anti-clotting agent of all is
having a normal hydroxychloroquine.
No, having a normal vitamin D level.
Oh, okay.
So your genes can turn on and off and talk to each other. And again, you know, again, our governments. I spoke to this in Ireland last week. Their government actually did a study and said, hey, it looks like vitamin D is going to be important for outcomes in individuals. Their research committee made a recommendation, and the government did nothing about it.
Yeah.
And there's so many meta-analytical studies now showing how important that was. So, these plots, you know, again, they're not normal. And the other thing, too, is I have several that – thankfully, from patients that are still living, where an interventional radiologist have gone in and extracted them. And then we've got those to study. Those came in when I was traveling, so I've got those to look at, too, and what proteins are present or not within those. So thankfully, some of the larger ones are getting extracted, and the patients are still with us. So, you know, it's unfortunate. Above all, COVID from day one, as much as people are like, oh, cytokine storm, pneumonia, and yeah, et cetera, et cetera, COVID is a clotting disease. COVID is and was a clotting disease. Now, Omicron clots less than the earlier variants. And this is where the risk versus, risk-benefit analysis, you look at the shot. The shot still has that Moderna sequence, and the S1 still breaks off and circulates and causes clotting. So the shots are more dangerous by about 20-fold on a clotting basis than Omicron as a virus itself. And so this is where, again, all those other harms we talked about earlier in this interview, the most dangerous of all is we're still giving a shot that is the clot shot. It causes clotting.
Right. You know, it's like the pandemic is self-created here. I mean, it's not the cure is, it's quite true that the cure is worse than the disease.
It is absolutely now, because the cure is a poor therapy that actually increases your risk of getting the virus, increases the volume at which you shed virus and transmit virus, causes all these potential pathways of harm in the body.
Right.
So that shot is far more dangerous than, I call it COVID now, for the majority of people that, you know, haven't had too many shots, it's mild cold. If you've had too many shots, it's pretty severe because you're immune suppressed.
Yeah. So it, you know, Matthew Crawford did a
I love
study.
Matt. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, he looked at the data from San Diego. Negative vaccine efficacy as soon as you did your first booster.
Yep.
So you're more likely to get infected, you're more likely to be hospitalized, and you're more likely to die.
Absolutely.
Now,
correct.
That is not even counting the all-cause morbidity and mortality from the shot itself.
Right.
That's just the effect relative to COVID. So these shots are a complete disaster. And for Ashish Jha to tweet, he had this tweet that said 94%. There are a few things in medicine that are 94% can reduce your risk of death by 94%, or you know, something like that. And it was like, wow, what planet is this guy on? I mean, how could he not be fired for saying something like that, that is so opposite of reality? He's like disconnected from reality. I mean, I used to respect him, but he's gone off the deep end on this COVID stuff. He's not looking at any data at all.
No, it's groupthink. It's not data driven, because they're neither. It doesn't matter if they're effective if they're not safe, and we already know they're not safe. So who cares what the efficacy is or isn't? But it, really, if you look at the efficacy numbers, the relative risk versus absolute risk reduction, the absolute risk reduction is near zero and was from the get-go for these shots. And again, we have all our government officials at this point saying, okay, you know, they didn't seem to work, and we knew from the beginning they wouldn't work. Birx has said it, Fauci said it, et cetera. And it's still this propagandistic ministry of truth from some Orwellian fiction that's now become a reality, that they continue to not look at data. To they're the purveyors at this point of mis, dis, and malinformation, because we can show them flip-flopping constantly and making claims that aren't true, and we can show it with data, and they're, you know, it's a false religion of scientism at this point that they're trying to push upon the minds of humanity for financial gain or power and control. Who knows, you know, what their motivation is, but it's obviously not based in science.
Yeah, so you know, I've been telling people that, you know, a lot of the issues with inflation are driven by the pandemic, and you know, people saying, "Ah, I'm afraid of going to work," or "It's hard to find employees," and all this, all, you know, causes these supply chain shortages, which then raise prices. And so, if we can stop the pandemic, we can get inflation under control, which means they don't have to raise interest rates, which means the stock market will go up, and everybody will be better off. There won't be shortages of materials like your contrast on the MRI, and we'll be back to normal. Now, the interesting thing is that we could be back to normal in a heartbeat, like almost like snapping your fingers, or you know, clicking your ruby red slippers, you know, three times and say there's no place like home, because it is so easy for us to get back to normal, and they only have to do one thing differently, in my mind. See if you agree with this. What they have to do is they have to stop listening to the people that they've been getting advice from and start listening to the people who have been actively censored.
Absolutely.
And once they do that, they will find that, hey, COVID is easily treatable. We just tell you, if you get COVID, stay home and start early treatment. And we will have these packs that you can buy for a discounted price of, say, $5, right? Because you don't want everybody just buying it just to resell or whatever. And you can, you know, get up to, you know, three packs a person, you know, per 6-month period or whatever it is, right? So people can't abuse it. But you get this pack, and the pack is your whether it's the Fareed-Tyson protocol or it's the FLCCC protocol, and we can keep stats and see which one works better and sort of rotate it in and out, and we're tracking the stats on this. But get the early treatment started immediately. And if you get hospitalized, then we're going to revise that in-hospital treatment to be something more like what's on the FLCC protocol for in-hospital care. And if and the other thing that we have to do is we have to stop incentivizing the hospitals to kill people. Because when you go on a ventilator and you die from COVID, this is like, yay, we just got another $50,000.
Yeah.
And, you know, the incentivizing hospitals to kill people is un-American. And nobody seems to be speaking out about that. You know, and so this is why people like me are silenced, because I'm saying that it's wrong for the U.S. government to incentivize hospitals to kill people.
Well, they're
apparently we shouldn't be saying that. You know,
well, they're not paying for Paxlovid. They're bonusing the hospitals for using remdesivir, which kills patients and has no benefit whatsoever other than to the pocketbook of the hospital administrators. They're giving things. I mean, and Paxlovid, you have 125 drug interactions, for heaven's sakes. With ivermectin, there's really one you worry about, and that's Coumadin, warfarin. And you can take 10x of an overdose, and technically you're fine. Studies have shown that. So you know, for them to demonize drugs, meanwhile incentivize and pay for dangerous, harmful drugs that enrich the pharmaceutical companies. For heaven's sakes, there are black box warnings on one of the components of Paxlovid.
Yeah, ritonavir, right?
Yeah, and we know it can cause severe liver damage, brain damage, heart damage.
Yeah, and plus all the drug interactions.
Oh, my God.
When you use ritonavir, it basically multiplies everything like crazy so it doesn't get out of your system, because they needed it to help Paxlovid be effective.
So to your point, I mean, yeah, we could have solved this a long time ago. There are brilliant minds, brilliant colleagues around the world, you know, Dr. Corey, Dr. Merrick, Dr. McCullough, Zeb Zelenko, people knew what to do early on. Dr. Urso down in Brazil, Dr. Lucy Kerr, Dr. Flavio Cattagiani, doctors in Italy, doctors around the world knew what to do right away. But this entire global lockstep plan of what happened was not in the interest of human health and wellness. It was the interest of power and control and financial corruption. And if we really cared about humanity, we would do what's right based on science, based on data for humanity. And that's, you know, you're very data-driven. I'm data-driven. And again, I'm willing to have a conversation with anybody, anytime, anywhere. You don't have to agree with me, but bring better data on behalf of the patient. And they don't do it. They won't talk to you. They won't talk to me, because they know. And sadly, you know, I'm forgiving. I can say, okay, you thought what you thought, but look at this. And if they would open their eyes and look, I think we would get back to a more normal approach and function. I mean, back in 2009 with H1N1 outbreak, it came to a point where they finally said, okay, we're just not going to test anymore. The flu's going to run its course. Let's, you know, supportively treat and just stop this game of panic.
Yeah.
And they did. So this goes far beyond that in terms of, you know, how they projected what they were going to do with Event 201 and other things like that. They projected how the media was going to act, how they were going to censor, how they were going to push for, you know, Fauci's shot that he, you know, projected onto us in 2017 in the interview at the Milken Institute with Rick Bright, where they said, gosh, it takes so long to get a vaccine to market. But in that interview, they're saying, well, if only we had a pandemic, well, we could emergency authorize this new mRNA technology. I mean, they projected it. And here we are.
What do you know?
Here we are.
What do you know? So let me just end with a question about Dr. Wakefield. Now, Andrew Wakefield, basically, 20 years ago, he discovered that vaccines were causing autism. And I think he probably also figured out that it's associated with the sudden infant death syndrome as well. And since then, I had an interview with him, and he said, you know, basically all the vaccines are dangerous. I asked him, hey, if you had to take one, which one would it be? So I wanted to find out, you know, which is the safest of all the unsafe ones. He said probably this, but it's unsafe as well. And I had asked him earlier. I said, so how bad is it? You know, how did the vaccinated kids, the kids that go through the entire childhood vaccine schedule, compare with the kids who have been unvaccinated? And I said, is it like, do the unvaccinated kids do like 10% better, 20% better in terms of the, you know, health outcomes and so forth? He said, no, not even close. It's like 10X.
Yeah.
10X.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, and if you look at under the reign of Fauci for 40-plus years, where childhood chronic diseases and illnesses have gone from 6% to about 54%, as we've added more and more layers of shots onto those schedules. And again, they'll say correlation isn't causation. Well, not a single childhood vaccine was ever tried in their clinical trials against placebo.
Yeah.
And you know how long the safety data monitoring was for hepatitis B?
Oh, probably a month.
4 days.
Oh, forgive me.
Right? So it's, I mean, to Wakefield's point, and he's a very courageous man, and what, you know, he gave up everything to stand for what was scientifically true and right.
Yeah.
And people don't have to, you know, again, the vaccine debate I understand, but the more I've learned, holy cow, talk about an awakening. You know, I got my childhood shots. I got shots when I was in the military. Never questioned for many years into medicine. And
right, we trusted. We don't have time to look at the data that Wakefield did.
No.
And he was discredited. They basically attacked him so that nobody would pay attention to anything that he did.
Right. Yep. And again, real science is whether you like it or not. I don't pick a side. I step back and say, all right, where's all the data? Where's all the observation? And if you're going to withhold data, which the CDC did, on the vaccine he was looking at, the MMR, you know.
Only the data that was negative, Ryan.
Right.
And the data that would cause vaccine hesitancy. That was the only data they withheld.
Right. And we found the journals have been corrupted by the pharmaceutical industries, and, you know, the double-blinded placebo-controlled trials are the ones that they get to. The journals are beholden to the funding from the pharma companies just like the media is. So if people were really interested in the truth, they would allow all data to come forth, truth and transparency, and then we could trust it. And if it's harmful, great, we don't go forward with it. If it's helpful to humanity, great, we do, or at least give people the option for it. But what we're finding is we're not allowed that transparency, and we're not allowed the truth of the data. And
right.
Because of that, it's time to start questioning everything. And those of us who are now awake to all of this, and again, we weren't before. Some, you know, were years ahead of us, and I'll give them credit for.
Yeah.
You know.
When did you stop getting vaccinated, Ryan?
You know.
When did you wake up?
My last shot was in 1986. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you awaken?
Well, I had one tetanus shot. You know, probably I don't know 10 or 15 years ago. I just kind of lucked into it because I've lived a pretty healthy lifestyle. I've never opted for a flu shot, and 1986 was my last shot in the military. So as much as I didn't have them, it wasn't because I was in this, you know, against what they were doing or how they were studied. It was just, I guess I was lucky in that regard. And
when was your red pill moment, really, when you realized that, man, this is a lot worse than I thought. I thought I could trust the CDC. I thought I could trust the FDA. Because for me, it was a year ago.
Yeah.
It was a little more than a year ago today.
For me, it was the moment that they said they were going to make a vaccine, the Operation Warp Speed, because I knew from all my studies, you know, I did PH work in immunology, part of my board training in pathologies and virology, you know, pathology, et cetera. The moment they said they were going to make a vaccine against the family of coronaviruses, that's when I said, wait a minute, you can't. And we've never been successful with vaccines against coronaviruses because of mutation rates, and they always mutate ahead of us and leads to antibody-dependent enhancement, cellular cytotoxicity, et cetera. The moment they said that, I'm like, oh, something is gravely wrong here, and they're taking a wrong approach. And that was my red pill moment, and I thought, okay, we have a problem. And that's when I dove into everything, all the other shots.
Houston, we have a problem.
Yep, absolutely.
Cool. Hey, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Steve.
For taking the 90 minutes here to talk with us. It was so awesome. Thank you so much.
You bet. And when I have some more data, I'm going to bring it forth, and we're going to make some I think we'll bring it forth on your show first, because I think we can make some groundbreaking impact.
Welcome.
Yes. Thank you. Thanks for
so
having me.
So we do it in English, because you come from
the United States and the state of Virginia on the East Coast, right by Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Robert, it's really an honor that you are here, and that is because of Brecht Arnert. He invites you to Belgium, if
yes,
I'm right.
Just so. He had a barbecue yesterday.
Oh, yeah, a barbecue.
In which, because it was very informal, in which we were able to, many of us, including Matthias and Gert, and Gert von den Busche, were able to speak to an invited audience of free thinkers, people that were open in their minds to considering things that aren't usually in the media.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great pleasure to speak openly and freely and learn also from my colleagues here in the lowlands. In the United States, we're very aware of the bravery and leadership of the farmers here in the lowlands, and very interested in understanding their point of view and their bravery, which is very similar to that of the truckers in Canada.
Canada.
Mm-hmm. And so when I was invited to speak by Brecht, I was very glad to accept, both because of the opportunity to learn and speak with these open-minded intellectuals, which seem to be occurring in this small country, and providing intellectual leadership like Theo and Matthias and Gert, and also to learn. I'm here to learn from my colleagues about how they see the world, so that I can bring back that learning to the United States and share it with my colleagues so that we have better alignment. I think one of the things that has become clear throughout this outbreak is that there has been a globally coordinated propaganda and public policy, it has been confusing.
It's very confusing. We speak a lot here in this room with Matthias Smet about that problem. I think he's the best in that subject. So today, Theo Schetters here, and to introduce you, you an American physician, biochemist, and you are part of our work. You focus on the mRNA technology.
And
or gentropy, how can I say it?
This is one of these early topics that I touched on that resulted in this very disproportionate response in the corporate media.
Yeah, but I know you from Brett Weinstein, his podcast Dark Horse. I think that was the starting point, and after that, Big by Joe Rogan.
Actually, the first podcast, so for me, I mean, I know for all of us, the podcast has been a journey. And my very first podcast was with a interviewer based in New York who asked me about antibody-dependent enhancement. And so it's that journey of starting with just trying to help people to understand what antibody-dependent enhancement was. Through this stepwise progression that has led me to this point and to your door. Through it, it has been a conscious decision on the part of myself and my partner, Dr. Joe Glasspool Malone, when we encountered the propaganda, censorship, defamation strategies of corporate media, that the only way that we hypothesized that the only way that we would be able to share the information that we knew to be true was if we threw ourselves into this new medium of the podcast in particular, which we were ignorant about. I was so afraid when I first started doing it.
But now you're a pro, I think.
Now I'm actually, people are using me as an actor now.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a very strange progression that I've had.
So just say that or something like that? Just say your lines.
Scripts, in particular, Mickey Willis has both interviewed me for his Plendemic series as a scientist and a thought leader, but also asked me to function as an actor in some of the things that he's doing, including one that will be coming up fairly soon that is a spoof of a American beer commercial. So stay tuned for that. But it has been I've had to learn all of these skills of communication.
I know, Robert. I'm kind of famous in the Netherlands, and I know what you mean, that what you all have to do. But we are really interested in you because you, for especially by Brett Weinstein, you are in the very beginning, and you kind of you know much more than we from mRNA. And you said, be aware, what you go to do. And it was very fascinating that we think, huh, what? The government says something different. So what are the points? So then now we go fast forward. If people want to know more, but we have limited of time here, then please go listen to Joe Rogan, or I can't find any more your podcast from Brett Weinstein. It's already shipped also?
It's still out there.
It's still out there. Well, so people can find that.
You may wish to look. YouTube is highly censored now.
Yeah.
At the time, the censorship was emerging, and now it's florid. So many have migrated to Rumble.
Yeah.
So then the problem is, of course, that Google actively manipulates the searching algorithm, as they did when I first spoke these three words, mass formation psychosis.
Yeah, what you have from Matthias, that goes viral, and that is the connection, I think, with you and Matthias, because you mentioned by Joe Rogan.
It certainly was a milestone. But my point is that to find these things, often one has to use alternative search engines.
Yeah.
I personally use the browser tool called Brave.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And you can find things more easily there.
Yeah. But fast forward, now we are here. So you are the one who raised the red flag already very early. Theo is here. So I want to try to pick your hats both. Where are we now? Perhaps, Theo, you can explain a bit how we did it in the Netherlands, because you even didn't know exactly if you were in the Netherlands or not. But because all areas has its own way of doing it, so perhaps you can explain, and then we can start discussion where are we now and how are we going further.
Exactly. Well, in the Netherlands, we don't have somebody like Brett Weinstein. So I spoke out, that was in 21, January 6th, actually at the day the first vaccination was given to a medic or a nurse. And I just said, like you said, this is not well researched. This is very irresponsible to start vaccinating the whole world with this material. You don't know the safety of it. I didn't believe in the efficacy at all. But of course, I'm a scientist, so you have to wait for the results. Yeah. So that was then. And now we are at the point where we see the results coming. So the things that we said right in the beginning, that vaccination against a respiratory disease by intramuscular injection is most likely not going to prevent any transmission, because you then talk about systemic immunity, which you actually evoke, and as opposed to mucosal immunity.
Just so.
Simple. Yeah. So that became clear. The other thing was that we knew it is a very mutating virus. So I always said, it's like you run with your syringe behind the virus that's running away from you. And so you can never keep up with the mutations. And actually, that's what we see. So also the Netherlands, the National Institute of Health, has said that people that have been vaccinated twice with the original vaccine, that at the moment there is zero protection anymore. So that's official result. That on the efficacy side. And then on the safety side, we also see problems. That's the most difficult part, because people do not want to talk about the safety. You know, there's so many people that contact me, because in the Netherlands I'm some sort of famous if it is about this. So I get emails and phone calls of people who have had very bad experiences after vaccination. And the sad thing is that although these people sort of obeyed the rules of the government and trusted them, now that they have these terrible side effects, the government doesn't want to listen. You know, so you just neglect it. We don't talk about it. And that's the situation at the moment. And as I said, it's I sometimes make the comparison that that it was a murder, and the body was thrown into the lake, and after a certain time that body surfaces, and this is what we see happening now. And that's a very difficult story.
Yeah, and perhaps something just, you know, we are different cultures here. We believe, as people who live in the Netherlands, that we are a very open culture.
Yeah.
And that we can talk about everything, and about the good and the bad. And also in science, we have a very open culture. Perhaps we are not the best, but we are very open-minded.
Well, you also, just to say it, in the world of virology, particularly veterinary virology, the lowlands have long been recognized as having particular excellence mm-hmm. in virology
mm-hmm.
And a unique way of thinking about particularly veterinary virology that comes from a commitment to food integrity, is my understanding, mm-hmm. and the belief that vaccines are a tool which should be deployed carefully mm-hmm. and logically
mm-hmm.
Because of the awareness in the food veterinary virology practice that vaccines can result in a situation where you enhance chronic infection, endemic circulation of pathogens, and that there are situations in which the culling of a swine herd or a avian flock can be more appropriate mm-hmm. than the vaccination of that, which obviously we cannot apply that directly to humans
no.
because of ethics, but there is this long history of independent thought in excellence in virology, yeah. in particular in the Netherlands, that I think often gets overlooked. But I, in my early training, mm-hmm. Was taught to recognize and respect the excellence of the lowland virology mm-hmm. community, mm-hmm. particularly in animal science.
Yeah, this is actually the vet schools of Ghent and of Utrecht are top veterinary schools. Eh? So that's where it comes from. But if you make the comparison, if I may,
yes, please.
When you talk about the use of vaccines in animal production, you have to realize that the animals are every time naive in animal production. And that's why the dynamics there is completely different from what we see in humans, because we are not naive. Right? So, of
particularly to coronaviruses.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But also, so what I'm trying to say is that so we get our childhood vaccination and then we are immune for life. And but in this chicken farm, it's not. You have the chicken there and after 6 weeks you have a new flock and they are all naive again. So there's a completely different dynamics there.
True.
And so that's what people have to understand, that it is classic immunology, of course. We have immune memory. which means that if we have seen it and we've survived it, then we are protected for lifetime until the moment that, of course, due to senescence and aging, our immune system starts decaying and we become vulnerable again.
Well, there's also, so this immune memory, like everything, is a double-edged sword. It has benefits and it has consequences. And we're now seeing the emergence of one of those unfortunate consequences.
Yes.
And the language that we use, the words that we use to call this phenomena, are immune imprinting,
yeah,
or the synonym, which is more sexy, original antigenic sin.
Yeah.
But can you, because that was really one of your of my questions, what is immune imprinting?
So Teo was just introducing us to that concept. In a way, it's one of these, you can look at it in different ways. When our immune system, by the way, our immune system is derived from the same embryonic source that our nervous system is. Our immune system and our nervous system are both incredibly complex. I think as biologists, it's important to acknowledge that these systems are so complex that we're still students. We're still learning of the underlying complexity in comprehending these interactions. And in the case of our immune system, the simple way that I try to convey this very complicated idea of immune imprinting or original antigenic sin is that we all know that as children and as adults, we experience the world. And the things which we experience bias how we respond in the future. The same is true with our immune system. What's one of the things that's a fascinating nuance about our immune system is this incredibly complex, adaptive, so we're talking about the more evolved immune system is like layers of a cake, these different types of immunity that go back to primordial organisms, okay? But in the more recently evolved organisms like mammals, there are these adaptive immune systems that we commonly call, we throw these words around, B cells and T cells, that learn, and they learn in a strange way. They actually evolve their response genetically. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Two Nobel Prizes for this,
yeah,
okay? That our immune system actually evolves in response to the antigens that it encounters. The thymus is one of the key organs for this,
yeah,
and it relates to why children are so much better able to respond to new pathogens is they have this, you could think of the thymus as the school, the university for your T cell response. And in children, it's very well developed. It's a big campus, the thymus.
Yeah.
And then it gradually collapses. But in the children, it's very actively educating. So what happens is that when we're children or adults, and we encounter something new, a new antigen, which is different from our normal antigens, ourself, our immune system develops cells that react to that. And it's a very complicated process wherein some of these cells are selected and they grow out, and other ones are suppressed that might react to that, but less effectively. And the end product is a form of memory, just like in our brain, but it's a very discrete memory. It is a population of cells, which we call memory cells, that are preserved in our bodies as essentially the memory of our immune system about that pathogen. So if we encounter that antigen, that new thing, that coronavirus spike from this particular coronavirus, from Wuhan 1, we have these cells in our body that are ready to respond to it. What happens with immune imprinting or original antigenic sin, by the way, it also happens with influenza vaccines, is that when one repeatedly administers these vaccines, we'll call them vaccines, that are based on a historic virus that no longer circulates, it trains these educated cells, these memory cells, to only respond to that one thing. It trains in a fascinating way. It says all other cells that sort of react to this, but not as efficiently, should die out. And only these ones that are very efficient at reacting to this thing should be preserved.
Mm-hmm.
The consequence is that if we now encounter a new version of this virus, which is what we have, let's say, just for sake of argument, Omicron.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let's say Omicron, the slang is ninja. Ooh, that's scary.
Mm-hmm.
BA5, the latest currently circulating that is now ending in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost gone.
Yeah.
Okay. But there is a fascinating body of literature now, very hard to do this immunology, from all over the world, that shows that this prior exposure to Wuhan 1, followed by the repeated dosing with Wuhan 1 spike,
mm-hmm.
trains your immune system to focus just on that Wuhan 1.
And forgot Omicron.
And then, well, I wouldn't say forgot Omicron. It is so highly educated. It's like the physicist who is so focused on string theory that he doesn't understand mm-hmm. Newtonian physics, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's akin to that, okay? So these cells are so focused on Wuhan 1 that Omicron has evolved to escape these
yeah.
types of responses.
Yeah.
So it's not that it's forgotten. It's that Omicron has exploited
mm-hmm.
the fact that we have trained all of our immune systems by this repeated administration
mm-hmm.
of a spike antigen that, for a virus that doesn't exist anymore,
mm-hmm.
doesn't circulate. And so it's created sort of a blindness
mm-hmm.
In all of our immune systems that have taken this repeated vaccination. So I hope that this is a very complicated idea, immune imprinting, but in a sense it's very simple.
Mm-hmm.
What it is if you think about a warfare metaphor, the army is always prepared like the Maginot Line, okay? The French before World War II, right? The army is always prepared for the last war.
Mm-hmm.
The same happens with your immune system, and if the enemy, in this case the virus, changes itself, using the metaphor, this would be the German Blitzkrieg,
mm-hmm.
right? The enemy has adapted to that situation. It's figured out how to get around the Maginot Line, and it blows right through it.
Yeah.
And it's even worse than that,
mm-hmm.
because of this phenomena. There's a recent science paper published about 3 weeks ago now from our current recording date that from a UK team that looked at healthcare workers over time, very solid study on top of many other solid studies that shows that these people that had early Wuhan, then the repeated dosing, and then get exposed to Omicron, actually develop an immune deficit.
Mm-hmm.
So their memory cells actually are less reactive when they encounter these new Omicron strains. And this appears to explain, there's many different, the clinical observation is that all over the world, what one is seeing in the data from governments all over the world, is this odd phenomena that the people that are highly inoculated, you know, those that are fully compliant with the government directive, they've received all these boosters, are the ones that are dominating hospitalization and death.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's various forms of artifacts within that data, but at the high level, that's the truth. You cannot
mm-hmm.
debate it.
Yeah.
All we can do is argue the nuance.
Yeah.
And so the question is, how could this be?
Mm-hmm.
And how could it be that repeated vaccination, which we've all been told would protect from infection, replication, and spread and disease, you know, that was the fallback.
Mm-hmm.
We used the slang in the Americas, the modified limited hangout, was that, well, it doesn't protect against infection. Well, it doesn't protect against replication.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it doesn't protect against spread, but at least it protects against disease.
Mm-hmm.
And now all the data show that that's not even true.
Mm-hmm.
And so the why is this.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't necessarily all due to immune imprinting, but in my mind, as I look at the data, peer-reviewed, high-profile publications, the immune imprinting data are very, very solid and strong, mm-hmm. as certainly a major contributor mm-hmm. to this paradoxical effect. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I could add something with regard to rising of variants, because some people give the idea that because of the vaccination, the virus changes, and that's not what I think. What I think is that these viruses change anyhow. So because of developing immunity, only the ones that are not recognized or killed by your immune system are the ones that will survive. That's also normal Darwinism, evolution. We are here because we survived until this moment in time and in history, and not on a sort of purpose.
The idea of Richard Dawkins that we're all just carriers of genes through time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's, I think, important to realize. Right? And the other thing is with regard to immune imprinting, of course, that plays a role, but also what plays a role, and that's that paper, also the people, group in the Netherlands from Radboud University contributed to that, is they have shown when people are vaccinated with mRNA vaccine that there is a sort of reprogramming of your immune cells. And so they've measured that there's a different response of the white blood cells of those people against viruses, bacteria, fungi, and even against tumors. That paper that was on the preprint server in May last year, and it's still not formally peer-reviewed and published, which I think, and then we come to censorship, is because it is a very inconvenient message that by vaccination with an mRNA vaccine, you change the core of your immune system.
That's why our introduction, then that's why I call it or gen therapy. So it's very difficult to say it like that, but you are one of the inventors. You already published in 1989 about this. So how do you see that? What can that mRNA do?
There's a couple of threads that touch on this. I'd like to start off with the language, the words, because words matter. Words are being very actively, the meaning of words, the meaning of vaccine, mm-hmm. the meaning of being an anti-vaxxer is now, for instance, redefined as anyone who has vaccine concerns or hesitancy is now an anti-vaxxer, formally defined in the dictionaries. Okay, there's been an active manipulation of words. When I spoke on Brett Weinstein mm-hmm. And subsequently, that in fact these are gene therapy technology applied to the indication, the medical indication of vaccination, there was an immediate censoring and defamation response with all the fact checkers. I find it very useful, my colleague Nick Hudson, who is a mm-hmm. South African actuary with Panda, key leaders of Panda, shared an idea with me recently that I find really useful. You can see, you can perceive the very sensitive topics by watching for a phenomenon that he calls the electric fence. There's an electric fence that gets built by the propagandists around any topic that is particularly sensitive to them. And if you touch on that, if you say words that relate to that, you will get an immediate response like a shock from an electric fence. And in this way, you can see what are the most sensitive topics. Okay? So, for instance, when I said mass formation psychosis on the Rogan show, it provoked this immediate knee-jerk response. Google started editing queries in real time. The press, international press, immediately attacked that, and they attacked and they tried to delegitimize Matthias and the logic, and yet it's a logic that goes all the way back to Plato and the allegory of the cave. I mean, this is ancient, fundamental academic knowledge. Okay, so this these words that this is actually a gene therapy also provoke that. Now, the question is why? And if you look at the Security and Exchange Commission documents filed by BioNTech and Moderna before all this happened, they explicitly acknowledge that this is gene therapy technology. It's part of their required disclosures to their investors where they speak about the risks. Okay, so this immediate reaction in me saying these words, this is gene therapy technology, was a revealing response that there was something very sensitive about using that language. So then the question is why?
Yeah,
why are they so sensitive to this, yeah. Okay? I have come to conclude that the reason is because the regulatory authorities, following the lead of FDA, I mean, this whole story has been really driven by a small cadre of appointed leaders under Mike Pence during the Trump administration, I'm being honest, okay, which one of the key leaders it's turned out is Deborah Birx. Deborah Birx, together with Bob Redfield, mm-hmm. who are both partners in the AIDS world, particularly in PEPFAR, the African AIDS Initiative. Okay, so they have this long history of working together. And they were put into their positions of power, her as Ambassador Birx on the Vice President's Committee for Response to the Coronavirus, and Bob Redfield as head of the CDC. And they basically created a narrative and a strategy, which they borrowed directly from the Central Communist Party of China. So the lockdowns and all those things, Deborah Birx now has written this book in which she openly admits that she accepted what we now know to be the propaganda coming from the CCP to the West and implemented it very aggressively. And part of that was the decision at the FDA level to employ the checklist, because FDA these days is very checklist-driven, as is EMA. The regulators have checklists in which they say this is a product of this category type,
yeah.
and therefore the steps that have to be taken are these. Here's the checklist. And they employed the vaccine checklist under yeah. the assumption that this was a classical vaccine technology, which it wasn't. They explicitly acknowledge that in the regulatory documents, but they elected, under political pressure from Mark Meadows, who, you know, in the office of the president, they elected to expedite all of this, to cut corners. It's the historic record. And one of the things they did was they chose to not treat this as gene therapy
yeah.
because gene therapy has a whole different checklist.
Yeah.
If it was a gene therapy, they would have had to do these tests about genotoxicity and other things. And since they employed only the vaccine checklist, they avoided doing those tests, requiring yeah. those tests. And there's a bunch of things they let Pfizer and Moderna and BioNTech get away with beyond this, that not only did they waive that, but they didn't even apply the full normal checklist that they mm-hmm. would do, like biodistribution, pharmacokinetics, and these kinds of things. They bypassed all of that. But in particular, if this is a gene therapy technology, which it is, then they should have employed the gene therapy checklist. And I think this is why this immense reaction is that by saying this is a gene therapy, using those words,
mm-hmm.
what it does is it clearly demonstrates the failure of the regulatory authorities to follow their own guidance
mm-hmm.
And employ the checklist that they should have used mm-hmm. for a gene therapy technology. And for me, when I was encountering this, before we know so much more now than we knew then, I was only saying, look, I invented this technology. I was at a gene therapy lab. It was explicitly an outgrowth of gene therapy research.
For cancer?
And no, it was actually, it was my focus at the time was trying to build, help advance the technology of retroviral vectors. And it was through a series of circumstances that I've talked at hours on other podcasts, that I came to realize that there was a fundamental flaw in the logic of gene therapy as promoted by Theodore Friedman in the 70s. That this pediatrician who posited the idea that we could treat genetic inborn errors of metabolism, genetic disease in children, by giving them the good gene. And it sounds very noble. It's one of these things that on the surface it sounds so compelling. Johnny has muscular dystrophy. All we have to do is give the correct dystrophin gene to Johnny.
It's three.
And then Johnny will be corrected. Or adenosine deaminase deficiency, or we could go on and on with the inborn errors of metabolism in children, sickle cell anemia. Okay? This simple idea. All we need to do is give the correct gene. In addition to the fundamental technology problems, which, for instance, Klaus Schwab and his colleagues completely disregard when they talk about transhumanism and gene therapy. Okay. Technically, none of these technologies are sufficiently efficient that we can actually create superhumans. Okay,
No.
They get tiny numbers of cells. But the logic that we can correct genetic defects completely missed the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because what was learned and was strangely first encountered at the Salk Institute in the laboratory where I was at Indoverma in the molecular biology and virology labs, working with here's a name that's well known here in the Netherlands, Dinko Valerio. Dinko Valerio was the senior postdoc in the laboratory. He was working on a whole new gene delivery technology involving a cold virus called adenovirus.
Mm-hmm.
And he left the laboratory and he created a new company called Crucell,
mm-hmm.
which is known here in the Netherlands a little bit. And he came to me a few years after creating the company at a conference, and he said, Robert, you're right. We need to pivot Crucell from focusing on gene therapy to focusing on vaccines.
Yeah.
And the problem is that was discovered in I interpreted it. It was an experiment done by Dr. Dan St. Louis in the lab, who found this problem. He would do a gene transfer experiment in mice, and the mice would produce the transgene protein for about 2 to 3 weeks, and then it would stop expressing. And I'm here surrounded by some of the best minds in the world in gene expression and oncogenes and regulation. Everybody thought it had to be a very sophisticated genetic mechanism. And I had just finished 2 years of medical school, and I went to the textbooks and I said, immune response timeline, loss of gene expression timeline, they're the same thing.
Yeah.
And so the hypothesis that the real problem was that the mice were making immune response against the transgene, which means that the whole discipline that I had chosen to invest my life in, I wanted to be a gene therapist and an MD, suddenly went right out the window. Yep. It was not feasible. Mm-hmm. And that's turned out to be the case.
Yeah.
The only places where gene therapy is working to any extent is in these privileged compartments like the eye that don't have much of an immune response, or you have to immunosuppress the patient just like you do with a transplant.
Yeah.
So that was the genesis of all of this, is the recognition that any gene therapy, whether it's RNA, DNA, adenovirus, retrovirus, adeno-associated, whatever your tech is, it has a fundamental logic flaw, and that is the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
But the synthesis that happened because I was there at the right time with an open mind and young and didn't know any better was, we can take the lemon, the gene therapy isn't going to work because of the immune response, and turn it into the lemonade of using it to produce a vaccine.
Yeah.
So all of this talk is just obfuscation. Mm-hmm. It's a fog that's been put out intentionally to obscure the fact this is explicitly a gene therapy tech. Mm-hmm. So thank you for allowing me to riff on that.
No, it's so great that you explain it to us, but because I really want to ask you something. If you listen to the government and you trust you trust this and you don't go like more interested people go to the podcast from Brett Weinstein and listen to Malone or mm-hmm. you. You also try to raise your voice from the beginning and you already have it in you.
Mm-hmm.
And now you hear stem therapy.
Yeah.
Then I think you're freaking out. So what
yes.
so can you help us to keep breathing?
Yeah. First, I would like to comment on one of the things that you touched upon, which I think we... not here maybe, but in the public we should discuss. We and these vaccines are here on the market. These companies earn an awful lot of money. Why aren't these companies not doing the research that we ask for? Because now, if we talk about, is there any risk that you get change in your DNA because of this technology, that's now been done by academics, by research groups who do it on Fridays afternoons because nobody wants them to do it, and that's what now happens. Will these companies have the money and the means and everything to do that? So that's
I'd like to comment on that really quick. I'll be concise.
Yeah.
You come from a more of an academic background. I come from this hybrid background of nonprofits, academia, industry, government. I've seen it all. The rule in drug development, if you're in the pharmaceutical industry, is you never ask any question that you aren't forced to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Because you may get an answer that you don't like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And this is explicit. And so the reason why they, frankly, bluntly, the reason why the pharmaceutical companies are not doing it is it's not in their financial interest to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And the regulators have failed in requiring, in doing their job, in
FDA.
Requiring that FDA,
yeah,
EMA, fill
yeah.
in the blank, okay? The global regulatory community has failed to do its job of in insisting on the correct application of the guidance
of
in
course.
The International
yeah.
Committee on Harmonization and the EMA and FDA regs
mm-hmm.
to insist that the pharmaceutical industry does its job.
Yeah.
That's how that ecosystem works.
Yeah.
Pharma will not do those studies.
No.
And governments will not fund those studies
mm-hmm.
Unless there is a forcing function that says you will do those studies because
mm-hmm.
we have all agreed, and we have.
Mm-hmm.
All of the regulations and documentation say that these things should have been done.
Yeah, exactly.
And there was a conscious decision to not – so this wasn't
no,
this wasn't
that's true.
Overlooked.
No, no. I agree.
There was a conscious decision to not force – the pharmaceutical companies to do the things that the regulations that we've all agreed upon over decades
just
required
away.
That they should be done.
Yeah. So that's on that side. Then coming back to your question, Melise, is that so how are we going to sort of bring this message to the public? Most of the people are vaccinated in the Netherlands. It's something like 75%. So you cannot freak them out by saying you have something in your body that's going to be at the end of your life. And
is it so strong?
No, because that's what I'm trying to say. In all fairness, it isn't that strong. So you have to, we know that it's not like that everybody is dying within a year after he has been vaccinated. But a certain percentage of the people has big problems with this. And the point is that I think we have to be open and fair about this, not only because of the corona vaccines, but because what we see happening is that this technology is being sort of introduced as we've used it in corona, it's accepted, everybody knows that, mRNA vaccines, you know.
Influenza,
yeah.
Monkeypox.
Exactly. So, and that's why we're fighting against, because we say this technology is not mature. It, maybe it can do something in the future, but we are certainly not at the point now to develop all these other vaccines or variants like an Omicron variant corona vaccine with the same technology. No, because you didn't solve that problem. And we have that problem. We have a problem of people dying after vaccination.
And getting sick.
And getting sick.
Including the children.
Yeah.
And,
so what do
and
we know
having,
now,
having
but,
reproductive health consequences.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So yeah. What do we now know then about the side effects? So this is the future.
Yeah.
Sounds horrible to me, but in the now, what can people be aware of? What kind of complaints that they can have, of what kind of that they now listen to this and think, what? It's connected perhaps to the
yeah. Well, that's the problem with this technology, because this mRNA travels through your body because of the LNP that they use.
Which physicians were told was not the case.
Yeah.
No,
so exactly.
It should stay in the arm.
But it does. So it potentially it affects all organs. And that's what these the medical doctors now see. They see all sorts of symptoms that they do not know what it is. And because the adverse events are so not just single one adverse event, but can be anything. They surface very difficult to a statistical level. And that's why we do analysis on all-cause mortality. Because, say, okay, and if we do not know what is exactly related to vaccination, of course, the coagulation problems, myocarditis, we know that. But there are many more things happening at the moment. And so that's why we look at all-cause mortality. And in the Netherlands now, it's very clear that there is a good correlation between the number of vaccinations that are given to people and the number of people that die within a week after that. So let's say in this week we gave 10,000 vaccinations, then in this week we have something like 125 excess deaths in that week.
And what kind of data then you use?
I use the data from the Central Bureau of Statistics and of our National Institute of Health. And the point is that they report that every week. They do not report the graphs that we make. So what they do is they show the cumulative build-up of the people, the number of people that have received the vaccination, the fourth injection. So then you see a curve that it goes up. You do not see the change per week. But if you calculate the change per week, and you then take the figures from the Central Bureau of Statistics, where they present you the excess mortality, that follows the same dynamics, the same.
So if you have more vaccines in that week, then you also have more excess
exactly.
death.
Yes.
If you have less vaccines in that week, you have
fewer
less
deaths.
Death.
Yes, yeah.
But that is, I got...
Yeah,
that,
yeah. And the point is, of course, we do not get the real, what we call the granular data, which means that we do not have this from person by person. These are group type figures. So that group received that a number of vaccines, and in that age group, you see this number of excess mortality. But we do not know whether this is really correlated one by one. And so that's why we ask for more data, because Ronald Meester said here, Ronald Meester is a professor in statistics, and we've discussed it here and said, okay, give us those data within a week. We know what's happening. Simple. But we don't get the data, so that leaves us with a correlation, with an observation. But I think by now it's getting so strong that at least if you talk about precautionary measures, that's the way they sold the vaccines, actually. They sold them as precautionary measures, so to keep us safe. Then I would say, I use the same argument now. If I see these correlations, although I cannot prove causality at the moment, from a precautionary measure, you should say, let's stop this.
Better safe than sorry.
Because imagine if that is true. Imagine it's half true. Right? The figure
but it's the data from... what they give you
but
by
he's,
themselves.
He's making a key point, and he's being very precise, academically precise and responsible. He is not saying that this proves that the vaccine is causing this excess mortality. He is saying that there is a statistical correlation. And I'd like to emphasize a couple things about this. In the FDA's own guidance for designing clinical trials for coronavirus vaccines, and for coronavirus therapeutics, one of their required endpoints is all-cause mortality. As a clinical trial specialist, this is always the case, is that one has to look at all-cause mortality. I'm going to give you an example to illustrate this, why this is important. In the development of the anti-cholesterol drugs.
Oh, that's a well-known drug.
So it illustrates the point very nicely.
Yeah.
Okay. In the development of the anti-cholesterol drugs, the logic was clear and compelling. There was a correlation between cholesterol levels and myocardial infarction. And there was a clear demonstration that this new drug technology would allow the reduction in the cholesterol levels. And so on the basis of this, there was a decision to license. And then as time went by, there was this paradoxical signal that came up again and again that all-cause mortality was actually up in people receiving these. Totally doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Cholesterol involved in myocardial infarction, drop the cholesterol. You should just as the same as now come out with the thinking behind the SSRI inhibitors. It's now documented in this last week that, in fact, there is not a correlation between a biochemical imbalance and depression. That was a false thing that's been taught to medical students for years and years and years.
Yeah.
Same thing with the cholesterol. And the paradox was revealed when they started to dissect the data. They found that there was an increase in depression and suicide with the people that had plummeted their cholesterol levels, because our brains need cholesterol.
Yeah.
Who would have thought that dropping cholesterol, we didn't know this before, we only detected it by looking at all-cause mortality. So all-cause mortality is the ultimate indicator for things that we didn't expect.
Yeah.
And that's why we always have to have it in clinical research, and yet once again, like so many other things, we have disregarded the learning of decades and denied the importance of all-cause mortality. And then we had this separate data set, these different people come in. They are the insurance industry actuaries.
Mm-hmm.
The insurance, life insurance industry makes its money
yeah.
by knowing precisely
the
incidence of death,
yeah.
okay, in different age brackets with different risk factors. They know this precisely, down to the sub-decimal.
It costs their money.
Because it's how they make their money. It's on the margins, okay? And there was this early signal last fall with a CEO of a multi-billion dollar insurance company in the Midwest in the United States that said that we are seeing an increase, unexplained increase in mortality that is 3 standard deviations. So this is statistical talk.
Yeah.
What it means is that's highly improbable to just be random, like highly, highly improbable. 3 standard deviations above the mean increase 40% in all-cause mortality in the bracket of the employed, because that was their customer base,
yeah.
was employed individuals who have life insurance policies, 18 to 64, people that shouldn't be dying,
yeah.
had this inexplicable increase in all-cause mortality that was, no one could understand. Now, part of this is because of groupthink. No one is willing to allow themselves to imagine that this could be the consequence of the vaccination. And so we ended up with this hunt. Why could this possibly happen, this sudden jump in mortality? Is it due to the virus? Hard to say. Difficult to pull that out of the data. And so over time, more and more and more data, more and more analysis, and Theo represents kind of the latest, most precise version of this analysis showing this tight correlation, statistically significant. And I think that's the importance, is it's not just his observation with these data. It comes on top of observation after observation after observation, including independent databases
yeah.
that are not subject to, let's say, government manipulations or underreporting or biases in hospitals about reporting correlations, because it's just deaths. I mean, when somebody dies, it's a very discrete endpoint. Yeah. You can't debate it. It's
you don't have to be a medic to see death or life. That's good, because otherwise you end up with an interpretation of a medic who...
Which is subjective.
And that's very subjective. You know, this, we have
so it's kind of the golden rule.
Yeah, some pathologists here who say, well, you can never know what the cause of death is if you do not do an autopsy.
Which is another thing, is there has been a paradoxical prohibition on autopsies.
Mm-hmm.
My colleagues like Ed Dowd, who are in the investment community, are able to say words that we as scientists and physicians are disallowed from saying.
Mm-hmm.
And what those in that insurance and investment community, like Ed Dowd, are able to say is that in their opinion, as they advise investors, when they perceive certain things, they can presume that there is underlying fraud. And when they observe these practices of suppression of information and unwillingness to disclose information, such as you're experiencing, I'm not saying that this is fraud, but they say that these are, as investors and investor guidance specialists, their interpretation is when you see these behaviors of hiding information, failure to disclose, it is considered from an investor point of view to be evidence of fraud.
Mm-hmm. Okay. At least it's a red flag.
What are you going to do now with this big bomb, or however call it?
Yeah.
Because the Volkskrant, that's the big newspaper in the Netherlands, Maarten Keulemans, he referenced to the CDC, and they said, oh, vaccination works.
Mm-hmm.
So it's for people also so confusing.
Well, that makes me think of the paper of Christina Stabel-Benn. You know, she looked at the total effect of mRNA vaccination, compared that with vector vaccines. And what she saw in her analysis is that there was indeed a positive effect measurable from mRNA vaccination, but at the end, bottom line, there was no positive effect. So there must in that group also be a negative effect. And that's the all-cause mortality that is showing you that. So that's the same thing here. And I think we have to be careful in formulating the message. Like you asked earlier, I'm not saying that everybody who has been vaccinated with mRNA is going to die within 10 years. I'm not saying that.
Yeah, because this paper said it can also by a part of the group perhaps has a good influence, that it's the chance that you're going to die reduce.
Yeah, it's what I, well, yeah, but that's an immunological thing.
Can I speak to that?
Yeah.
On President's Day this year in the United States, so this is a national holiday, President's Day, it's in February, the New York Times published a paper in which the New York Times, which is generally very closely aligned with the government and the official corporate positions, okay, this is corporate news, the New York Times published a paper in which they explicitly said two key things. The CDC has been intentionally withholding data on the vaccines and on COVID all the way through the outbreak.
Ooh.
Okay, and the New York Times explicitly said that the CDC has become politicized. It is functionally a political arm of the administration, of the White House, of the executive branch, and it is no longer functioning as it once was,
mm-hmm.
as an independent arbiter of truth. It is now an integrated political organization supporting the narrative and the political agenda of the executive branch. And so these statements that CDC says this or CDC says that are, per the New York Times, no longer valid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they have withheld information from physicians and public health officers to advance a pro-vaccine agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And they are explicitly a politicized organization in an environment in which the President of the United States, not just Tony Fauci, has made a clear, unequivocal statement on the record, on video, saying if you get vaccinated, you will not get infected. Mm-hmm. And of course, that whole narrative has just collapsed over the last 3 weeks with Gavin Newsom getting infected, Justin Trudeau getting infected,
Biden.
Tony Fauci getting infected, and now Joseph Biden getting infected. Okay, these are highly vaccinated, highly compliant individuals, and like many all over the world that have been highly compliant because they wanted to do the right thing,
mm-hmm.
right? They thought they were doing the correct ethical thing. No fault on them.
Mm-hmm.
They were following the government. The government was teaching them that they had a moral obligation not only to protect themselves but to protect everyone else and the elderly,
mm-hmm.
that they needed to take these vaccines. And so they have done their civic duty. And unfortunately, now the data show that these are the people that are most likely to get infected and have disease, hospitalization, and death, and moreover, because of these things we were talking about earlier, to get repeatedly reinfected or chronically infected.
And longer.
And as you've got the paper, I noticed you picked out that paper, brilliant, from the New England Journal. You are very prepared. So recent paper from the New England Journal, admittedly small numbers. This gets into Theo's world of statistics. This is a small initial report. But the actual – and the authors downplay the data,
mm-hmm.
because
the data
they don't read statistical significance. Yeah. But the trends in the data clearly show that the highly inoculated are – the virus is persisting longer in them. And many of us know from our friends and family that – and our coworkers – that the people that are getting repeatedly infected are the highly vaccinated. And here's why that matters, is because there are separate data. This whole discussion of what is driving the mutations, and many things are driving the mutations. Viruses mutate, as Theo said in the launch. I mean, it's just intrinsic.
Yeah.
Viruses are amazing little evolution factories because
they're
such large numbers. They have billions of children, right? There are clear and compelling data that among the spectrum of humans contributing to the evolution of escape mutants, viruses that are able to escape the immune surveillance, particularly of vaccination, one can easily track evolution in people who are immunosuppressed for some reason. Whether they have cancer, chemotherapy, innate immune defects,
AIDS,
not just AIDS, and also these repeated inoculations, it is in the scientific world, just because you can see it here doesn't mean it's not happening there, but you can clearly see it in these people just like you can with the AIDS virus. With the AIDS virus, one of the fascinating things in virology and immunology is that we've been able to see the evolution of the virus in each individual patient over time, and now we're seeing that same thing happen with
corona.
These people that have these chronic coronavirus infections. And so what this plays into, and I hesitate almost to say this, but there was such a concerted propaganda effort to make the case that it was the unvaccinated that was putting the world at risk, but the data that I see, I don't want to represent Theo, but the data that I see demonstrates that the highly inoculated and the immunosuppressed are contributing to the evolution in a significant way of escape mutants, whereas those that have the broad-based immunity that comes from the natural infection by the mucosal route, seem to be controlling the virus much more effectively, presumably because they're not just trained respond to spike, but they're responding to all of the whole spectrum, diverse, you know, diversity is good, right?
Yeah.
In immune response.
Yeah. But then coming back again, because we still haven't answered that question, how are we going to convey this message to the public?
Yeah,
and I think we have
example, your graph, what you make, what are you going to do then with that?
So,
Rutte van Dissel?
So what we've done is I've written a registered letter to the director of our Institute of Health and presenting the results and expressing my concerns, and just with a question, from a precautionary point of view, please reconsider vaccination strategy, because I think this is a real warning. And so it's not that everybody dies, and I do a rough calculation, it's 1 in 800. But then again, I mean, these are then...
1 in 800 is a pretty big number.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big number.
But this is...
The myocarditis incidence now is publicly acknowledged by some governments as 1 in 5,000.
Yeah, I know. And so what I talk about is, of course, the vaccination campaign that's now going on. That's the nice thing in the Netherlands. It's done in campaigns. So if you have a danger signal, that comes easier to the surface because it's... The vaccination is in a small time window, so you can easily
follow it up.
Yeah. And what was I saying? Oh, yeah. That's given only to people of 60 plus age. Yeah. So that's maybe explains why you have a relatively high number, if it is causal, of people that die, because you also have the very old. And
so this is crucial. And this was something that was pulled out of the early data at least a year ago, is, and it was one of the logic flaws that I had made and others had made. We criticized the CDC and these other public entities in, this is more technical talk, not stratifying the risk of the virus, meaning
exactly.
The truth is that virtually all of the risk for death of the virus is isolated in a very small age window of really 65 and above. Okay, that's almost all the deaths.
Yeah.
And so we presumed illness. I wrote op-eds with Peter Navarro saying we should focus our vaccination just on these people that need it most and let the rest of the population, more like what Sweden eventually did, acquire natural immunity, and save the vaccine rather than driving the evolution of vaccine escapements for these people that needed it most. And then the data came out that not only is the risk of the virus stratified by age, but the risk of the vaccine is stratified by age. And when you do that age stratification analysis, which is what is normally done, but has been hidden from us, then you find that the adverse events also cluster in these people that are aged, that have underlying conditions. And that sounds like, from what I'm learning from you, is that this excess mortality signal that you're detecting that correlates with the inoculation campaigns may be stratified also by age. And that would be entirely consistent
with all
the other data.
Which is true. So if I break it up in three age groups, then you see that the most of the mortality is in the plus 80.
Which is unfortunate, because they're the ones that need it the most.
Exactly.
But we cannot look away from the truth.
But, Robert, at this point of time, do they still need vaccination? Because we talk about Omicron, we talk about a good level of herd immunity here. And so what is the risk now for the people of those ages?
Which is why, so among other things, I stand as the president of the International Association of Physicians and Medical Scientists. So we're 17,000 that are only physicians and medical scientists, all verified, no nurses. Not because we don't like nurses, but it has to do with the positioning with the press and messaging, okay? So that's the basis for our organization. Months ago, we came out with a press conference and a clear, unequivocal statement that one can find at globalcovidsummit.com, where we made a clear, unambiguous statement, in our opinion, as an organization, these vaccines should be withdrawn. Mm-hmm. They are no longer justified on a risk-benefit ratio.
Yeah.
As the person who is responsible for the genesis of this technology, I'm often criticized, didn't I realize what I was doing? There's no way for me to have known that the normal standards for regulatory development and testing and clinical would be circumvented.
Yeah.
I stand as someone who has intimate, detailed knowledge of the technology and its risks and benefits, the nature of the formulations, the role of the pseudouridine, all of those things. It's my opinion and that of the organization that I represent that the data are now sufficiently clear that, in our opinion, the ongoing campaign for vaccination is no longer warranted.
I agree.
And furthermore, it's our opinion that early treatment saves lives, that we now have a broad spectrum of early treatment options. All of the press attacks about ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, even if you set all those aside, there are plenty of other agents, the novel agents, monoclonal antibodies, many things. What matters is that these, our elders, our high-risk individuals, have immediate access to therapeutics
if
they develop symptoms, just like the president, just like Tony Fauci.
Yeah.
The same standard should apply to any of our high-risk individuals.
Yeah.
But likewise, we should not continue with this everything deserves the same hammer.
One size fits all.
Yeah.
Such as Pavloxin, which a recent science op-ed clearly outlines that this protease inhibitor strategy against the main protease, which is the mechanism of Pavloxin, is highly susceptible to vaccine escape, just like the vaccine, to viral escape. And we're observing that.
Yeah.
And it was a known risk with protease inhibitors. It is a known risk with HIV protease inhibitors. Yeah. We know all of this science. I sat on the committee at NIH, the foundation for the NIH, called the Active Committee, during the time when these drugs are being tested, the active trials. And it was explicitly acknowledged at that time that this single agent strategy, you know, as a virologist, it was a total setup for evolutionary escape of the virus. And what that means is not that we should not use the drugs.
No, but in combination.
We should use them in combination, and we should use them selectively for the people that need them most. And we have Pfizer, the manufacturer, halted their clinical trials for Pavloxin because it wasn't working, it was not effective in people of average risk. Okay? So we have multiple lines of evidence that one should not just blindly use this drug every time somebody gets infected. Mm-hmm. We need to use these things wisely.
Yes, like you have to do with vaccines.
Just so.
Okay, thank you both enormously. I think it was a very learning conversation for me as well.
Yeah.
And thank you for your time, and thank you for coming to the Netherlands.
My pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity to be here and learn from all of you. I'm so grateful to learn of your courage and your work. I certainly empathize with the academic backlash and the corporate media backlash and the censorship and propaganda and defamation and gaslighting that so many of us have experienced.
Mm-hmm.
But in the face of all that, you continue to be courageous And I thank you for that.
Yeah, well,
I honor you.
Thank you, Robert. That's mutual. The same. You are an inspiration for a lot of us. So I was happy to talk with him.
But now you have to go to your wife.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Kijk jij ook graag naar onze uitzendingen? Vergeet je dan niet te abonneren op ons kanaal. Bedankt voor het kijken en tot ziens.